Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Wherever you are, whenever you're listening, you are listening to the Dom and Colin podcast. My name is Colin, and I'm here, as I always am, with Dom. Dom, how are you doing this week?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm doing very well, because we have a giant episode. We're going to be going over the last couple episodes of Survivor Karamoa and talking about a lot of stuff. So much to get to. I've got my iced coffee ready. I'm ready to do this thing. Just as a heads up, this is probably going to go pretty long, but we're very happy to be back. Nonetheless, we're going to try not to make it last forever.
Yeah, for various reasons, because we spoke to Max a few weeks ago, or rather you did, and then that was kind of a departure from our normal format, where we didn't speak about a lot of the things we usually would have spoken about. And then episode 10, for various reasons that week, like scheduling problems, internet problems, we weren't able to get a show out then. So this is basically recapping the past 3 weeks of Survivor. And usually, you know, that's a downside. We'd like to be able to talk about things in the moment as they're happening, like in a timely fashion. But here, it might actually work out for the best, because I feel like this episode has closed one chapter in the season, if you like. And so it's nice to be able to talk about all that stuff with the benefit of hindsight.
Yeah. Actually, you know, before we get into Survivor Karamoa, just a couple very quick things before we get started. For people wondering, I know we've gotten some questions about this. Big Brother Canada, it's going to happen. I think at this point we're going to do, once the season is over, we're going to do a big podcast talking about the whole thing, all the players, the power shifts and everything, what we liked, who we didn't like. For now, though, Dom, very quickly, just to give the people a little taste, Big Brother minicast, who's your winner pick?
I mean, it has to be Emmett, right? His position is slightly more precarious than it could have been going to this week, because I have to imagine if either Gary or Tyler win Vita, then they have to strongly consider taking out Emmett. Whether or not he's going to be able to snow them over and keep them in check is another question. But it's been kind of awkward, because we originally planned to talk about this, I think, before Alec was nominated originally, so when there were 8 or 9 people left. And I think that would have been a great time to do it. But over like that 3 week stretch, then Alec gets eliminated. The double eviction, Topaz goes, nobody really cares, and then Peter goes, and now all of a sudden we're at Final Four in a spot where it seems like there's one obvious winner and there's not too much to talk about. So saving all that for post-game, that seems like the right call there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I'm with you. I think Emmett is the big, big favorite if he can get through Final Four. I think everyone's taking him, and I think he beats everyone. So that will conclude, I think, the Big Brother minicast. And I think we're good to get talking about some...
It could be a nice sneak peek. What do we want to get onto first, you think? Because obviously there's been a lot to cover, and there's been some Survivor-related stuff which hasn't like tied into the show that's happened over that time as well. So where do you want to get into this?
Actually, let's start with a very quick Hans update, because a couple of things going on here. The one I'm most excited about is apparently the Hanses, 4 of them, Russell Hans, his brother Willie from Big Brother, Brandon Hans, who we know from this season in Survivor South Pacific, and Brandon's dad, Russell's brother Sean, and Willie's brother, I suppose, too. Russell's tweeting up a storm about how they have a show coming out, and we don't know what it's about, we don't know anything, even the premise of it, but I gotta say, I'm very much looking forward to that, just having seen Flipped Off and not having it intrude upon my CBS reality shows.
Yeah, I feel like I've long since reached saturation point with the Hanses. I think That might just be exclusive to Survivor, though. Maybe they can be interesting in some other context where it doesn't feel like we're just being bombarded with them constantly over and over again. Like, where is it a point where it's not them dominating the franchise that involves one of my favorite shows? Maybe I'll be more receptive to that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. As we said, when Brandon got, not voted off, I would still stand by not voted off. But when he was done, I strongly believe that's going to be the end of the Hans era on CBS reality. But like I said, these guys do know how to make good TV. I just don't like it when it comes in and fucks up what was already a really good thing and completely changes it. And I think just one other thing worth pointing out about the Hans is from the story checks out department, Brandon and his wife have separated again.
And also in the same department, like Brandon managed to make that as public as you can possibly make it.
Oh yeah, a subtlety, not his strong suit. His new Facebook picture is him like in bed with some other girl. It's pretty brutal. But yeah, I mean, we've said enough about Brandon, I think, over the course, and well, this is not shocking whatsoever.
Well, incidentally, for those of you who listened to the podcast that Rob did with Sophie Clark this week, which I know was controversial for a lot of people, I think this is like the best example of the kind of objection people had to that, where not only was she making these bold personal criticisms of people, but at the same time she was doing that, she was defending Brandon as a fundamentally good guy, as if everyone else is somehow worse by comparison. It's weird.
I was thinking to myself, because, you know, in hearing so much, we've talked to so many people from South Pacific, and hearing everything we've heard, it seems clear that if Brandon had made it, he was going to win. And I feel, if I was one of those South Pacific jurors, or Sophie, who, if hypothetically, if she's not there, Brandon wins or whatever, where I would, once I see how he performs in season 26 now, I would be like, really quickly trying to remove from the record that I was ever considering voting for this lunatic, not reinforcing that. Yeah, so I think, you know, with all of that out of the way, we're going to be getting into the last few episodes of Survivor. I don't know how much we're going to be covering from each episode, because we're trying to keep this relatively tight, at least for us, as far as time. So yeah, Dom, anything to add before we get into this?
Yeah, I think for people who have moved on from the past few weeks and just want to hear about this week's happenings, we'll put a time markers for each episode segment in the show notes, so that if you don't care about episode 9, episode 10 anymore, you can skip over that and get on to this week.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, care about episode 9 and 10, we surely do. And I think, actually, as you mentioned, this could be kind of like a blessing in disguise that you had life-altering exams that you had to spend 20 hours a day in the library for, because a lot of really wacky stuff has gone down these last few episodes, and it's been really great TV, of course. But I think there's a lot of, like in discussing, for instance, Malcolm and his play with the hidden immunity idols when he played both at the tribal council and Stealth LRS was forced to turn on each other. I think a lot of that, we surely would have wasted 45 minutes about speculative stuff there. I think now that we've seen the results, we're going to be able to have much more concise and more accurate, ideas about how to analyze that move.
Yeah, accurate in the sense that we know what happened, and that's going to, inevitably, no matter how hard we try to remain objective, that's going to influence what we say. But I think the best way to do it is to talk about what we were thinking at the time and then compare that with how it actually seems to have played out.
Right, okay. That's episode 10. Let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. Episode 9, I think the place we want to start is Sherry's kind of indoctrination, into Stealth R Us, where it starts off basically, I think, like Philip just hitting on her. I don't know if that was strategic or whatever, but yeah, let's get into this.
Yeah, Philip randomly seems to have this little boy crush on Sherry, and so he's kind of taking her under his wing, if you like, and seems to want to make her into his own personal Philip, I guess, doing the same thing to her that Bottomlob did to him. And I think the most interesting part of this is not whatever Philip wants to do, but the way Sherry reacted to it, because this seems to be like a conscious effort on her part to ingratiate herself with this group, and in keeping with what she did with Shamar before, she seems to think that the best way to do this is to latch on to the craziest, the most unstable person in the group and use that person for her own ends.
See, this is, I think, something I talked about a little while ago, and this may be what we're seeing out of Sherry, which is I feel like Boston Rob has completely just changed the way people look at the game, and they view that kind of Boston Rob approach and the BR rules as, like, optimal Survivor play. And I feel like Sherry... certainly there's merit to it, of course, but I feel like Sherry, this situation may have been what's led Sherry to stay with Stealth R Us for so long, where seeing Boston Rob and how he used exactly Philip, this person she now has to deal with, where I feel like she could have been potentially in some situations where a flip might have been better, and I'm sure we'll be talking about this, but she has these BR rules in her mind where you want to drag the goats to the end and try to just mind fuck people into not acting in their own best interest, and I feel like Sherry's had some situations where she could have, if she weren't of such that mentality of this is the way to play Survivor, would have acted differently.
Right, and she has the first of a series of confessionals, actually, where she says, Philip's my new Shamar, all you need to do is give me two votes and I'll be at the top of the totem pole again calling the shots. And if you look at any one of these in isolation, that's a fantastic confessional. It shows that, you know, she's really thinking about her position in the game, that she has this plan in mind to vault to the top of the pecking order. The trouble is, though, if you look at all of these together and compare them with what's actually going on, it starts to look like she just is going to think that no matter what, and, you know, she's had this amount of time to put those efforts into practice now, and it doesn't seem to be working.
Yeah, so actually, let me ask, do you think that Sherry's seemingly unwavering loyalty to Stealth R Us is a result of how well Philip brought her into that group? Or is Philip the one to get credit for it, or is someone else?
Yeah, I hate these efforts that I'm seeing by people to make it look as if Philip is the one calling the shots, in the sense that, you know, just getting your own way is somehow a mark of how successful your gameplay is. When, like, Philip clearly has no long-term thinking in play here. Like, he's not working towards the ultimate end of the game, which is to get into a final two or final three with people you know you can beat and lock up a win. We know that Philip is drawing there to win and possibly even to just get a vote at all.
See, and this is something, this is a very big thing in how I look at Survivor, which is Sophie brought up again on her interview with Rob, where talking about Philip thinks he's calling the shots and everyone's kind of falling in line despite not respecting him and him not having a plan. Either way, he's still the one calling the shots. But for me, like you just said, there's clearly no long-term plan here. And a huge part of how I look at Survivor players is intent, like thinking out their moves and why they're doing what they're doing rather than just kind of spazzing. And it seems like Philip is getting credit for his personality just being so mentally inflexible that people know I'm either going to be with Philip or against him.
Yeah, like when you know that the only reason people are even tolerating Philip, like they're not being upset about the baby kicking toys out of the pram, is that they know that they can beat him in the end and they just want to drag him there, and that he is so irrational and so easy to anger that any small thing you say might set him off the rails. That doesn't paint him in a good light at all. That shows that it shows that he's not persuading people that they need to be on board with his ideas. All he's doing is not shifting that balance so far in the other direction that it no longer becomes the right idea to keep him there.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and again, it's like Philip, the whole thing is he's just such a juicy piece of steak to take to the end, I feel like. And I'm sure, you know, we over the course of this, we're going to be talking about, we've subsequently lost Philip. And I feel like removing Philip from the game, not that he's a good player, but again, he's just such always going to be a presence in the game, be it people hating him or people wanting to drag him to the end, but he's pretty impossible to ignore. Yeah, actually, one thing you just hit on is Sherry's had some really interesting confessionals to me, and if she wasn't so invisible this whole time, I would feel like she'd still be a winner contender. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's weird. It seems like every time she speaks, she gets contradicted. Like, she's making these assertive claims about how she's going to drag Shamar to the end, she's going to drag Philip to the end. Every time she says something like that, whoever she's saying it about seems to leave the game in some fashion, right? So she says that she's going to make Shamar into her Philip, then Shamar gets medevaced. She says she's going to suck up to Philip and work her way in like that, and then Philip gets blindsided. Maybe this is a story of how either Sherry loses in the finals or why Sherry gets taken out before. It's that, you know, she goes from being this big power player to someone who just can never find a footing in the game due to circumstances outside of her control.
One thing that actually stands out to me about Sherry, and I'm just piecing this together, is do you feel like in her current position, or in her position at any point after the merge, that she would have been better off being a favorite? Because I don't think she's going to make the finals, but I think a big reason might be, oh, we can't let a fan in because they'll just default get the votes.
Well, I think it's the opposite, if anything. I think Sherry's in a really awkward position where people might want to take her to the finals because they realize that she's not going to get the votes of the other fans, namely Eddie and Reynolds. She could get Michael, I suppose, but like that's one vote in a jury of eight, potentially. And as we discussed a while ago, I think the favorites as a group, no matter what actually goes down between them, are going to be very reluctant to let a fan win, because that's the ultimate statement of, look, the group of us failed, like both individually and collectively.
So even the jurors, you would extend it that far?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Okay. So this is why it's so tough for her, because if she goes against most of the favorites, like maybe there are some combinations where she has a chance, but if she goes against the favorites, I think she loses. And if she goes against the fans, firstly, I think she just loses to Reynolds straight up. And
yeah.
Secondly, maybe even Eddie, depending on how he gets there. And secondly, like, Eddie and Reynolds are the two people who are most alienated from her and the least willing to work with her. So for her to even get to the finals with them in the first place would require some bizarre set of circumstances.
Very true. I guess I just more was thinking, like, and kind of actually based on what we were just talking about these confessionals she's getting, she seems like she understands what's happening. And I feel like that definitely comes across to the people that she's interacting with out there. And I feel like the reason we're so dismissive of her as a potential winner candidate is because of her edit. But I feel like out there in real time, they don't have that same knowledge. They can't just dismiss her. And she seems, at least to me, like someone who roughly understands, if not greatly understands, what she's doing. And that would concern me if I was a favorite.
Well, also, I feel like the game that she's playing, while probably being the only thing she can do, given the hand she's dealt, is also something which doesn't really come across well to the other people out there. Because let's say you're one of these favorites who only met Sherry for the first time after the swap or at the merge. You don't get to see the level of control she had over the first fans tribe, right? You only get to see her after the swap just being in a position where she doesn't have to go to tribal council, and if she did, she'd just be voting with the favorites anyway. And then after the merge, what's she doing? Well, again, she's flipping over to the favorites and not actively asserting herself, because that's the best way to fly under the radar and get herself in with the group. So that's the kind of game which doesn't, but I could see not looking very impressive to a jury, and which she would have a hard time defending.
So say you are Sherry then, and you've kind of trotted along with this pretty automatic game plan. If you get to the finals, what's your pitch?
I guess the pitch is that assuming she's up against two favorites, is that, look, I came in here with no experience, whether you came in or having played the game once before. I didn't have any prior relationships with anybody. I had to hustle for 39 days, whereas you got to coast for a while. Like, my tribe were constantly losing challenges. I had to poke people out while you just got to sit there. You know, I had to work to get myself to this point, and I did that better than these two did.
Okay. Yeah, and again, I think it's more whether you can sell your moves as not even so much aggressive, but mandatory and well thought out, versus, and they can be boring if they're still good, I think is kind of the point, which is you can argue good, boring moves over bad, big moves, I think. But at the same time, like, Sherry is going to, if she does make it, have a really tough case to make because she hasn't really done too much, at least yet.
It makes me wonder how much the jurors' perception of the finalists comes down to tangible achievements that they can point to and hold up as things that they did, and how much of it is due to the way that the jurors present their case. So to go back to Sophie for a minute, and this isn't a criticism, it's just an observation. I wonder how much of the jury's willingness to vote for her was due to her ability to, like, confidently present her case in contrast to Albert's perceived seasoniness and coach's inability to own up to the move that he made, and how much of it was due to things that she actually did. Because, yeah, she beat Ozzy in a crucial challenge, she won some other immunities at some point, but her game wasn't a flashy one. It was one which was defined by inertia, because the correct thing for her to do at every point was to maintain the status quo, because the status quo was going to lead to her making the finals and having a shot to argue the case in the way that she proved that she could. That might have been a unique case, though, because it seemed like that was a decision which was generally up in the air going into Final Tribal, because if Coach runs up to his game, or if Sophie does some things differently, it's possible we have an entirely different result, right? Whereas here, I can easily see, if Shrey makes the finals, that perception of her as a floater or whatever will be so ingrained that it'll be hard for her to top that, no matter what kind of performance she puts on. I can see, for instance, if Eddie and Reynolds were in the jury house, not poisoning the jury, but I imagine they'd be cheerleading against her. Or if there are favourites there who don't like her for some reason and are making that argument, that would be very difficult for her to overcome, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this style of play has worked before, but I think it's more often a function of who that kind of player is sitting next to, like we talked about with Sophie. And I feel like Sophie is honestly too high of a bar to compare Sherry's game to. I feel like Sophie did more than Sherry foreseeably would if she makes the finals here. But because she was there against Coach, who wouldn't own up, and Albert, who people didn't like, or like Amber in All-Stars, never had any really tough decisions. She just kind of listened to Boston Rob, and then people had their feelings hurt by Boston Rob. We've seen this style of play win, but it's not so much on the merits of that individual. It could be kind of anyone, as long as they're not the other person that they're facing in the finals.
Right, and it's harder for her in the final three as well, because conceivably, if Philip had stayed in, she may have been able to drag him to the end, or let's say Dawn continues having breakdowns and turns into a goat. It's conceivable that she would be able to find one person that she can convincingly make a case against, because there's always going to be that third person there who could be the spoiler and be the default recipient of any votes, of the votes for anybody who doesn't like Shay, but also doesn't like the second person that she wants to beat.
Right, yeah, I guess bottom line for me about Sherry, you know, through over all of these episodes, basically since the merge and going ahead, is get to the finals in such a position where you can make distinct, unique arguments for your own game that don't line up with everyone else. Because I feel like that's basically the only way.
Because if we were having this discussion about anybody else, we might say, well, okay, Philip being taken out, it kind of sucks because now they have to find a new goat, but maybe they can go to the end with Eric or Brenda or like Sherry if we're talking about somebody else. But for Sherry, though, like, let's say she manages to get to the end with Eric and somebody else or Brenda and somebody else. I think Eric could win in that case. I think Brenda could win in that case. You know, it's not, even in her ideal configuration, it's not going to be easy for her.
Definitely. Anything else on Sherry right now before we get into some other stuff?
Well, to go back to the original comment then, I wonder if you think that this storyline, if you like, of her almost assuming power but then things falling apart, is that, are we meant to read into that, or is that just, like, a story that they're trying to cultivate?
I don't think Sherry's going to be the third finalist. I have two finalists already just locked in, I think, in Cochran and Dawn, and I feel like Sherry, I don't know if it's going to be some kind of poetic storyline or whatever. I feel that Sherry, I don't think she's going to come close to making it. I don't think it's going to be, oh, I just need this one thing to go well for me, and then it doesn't go well, and we have this kind of retrospectively ironic storyline about Sherry the entire time. I don't really see that being the case. I see it being just missed opportunities, like several things that could have gone her way, and maybe she didn't play them right, maybe she did, but there wasn't just a good winning line for her, basically since the merge, I don't think.
Fair enough.
Okay, so I think progressing forward now, I want to talk about this reward challenge, and specifically Cochran off on this reward. This is, of course, the Dan Limbo special where they throw the balls past the goalie or whatever. This I thought was quite important as far as the overall arc of the season is going to go. So let's get into this a little bit.
Yeah, firstly, just quickly about the reward challenge. The way they designed it was like you couldn't basically lose if you just arced the ball over the defender, because the way it was angled, like it was set up so that you could just do that, and there's nothing the defender could do about it.
Right, yeah. No, challenge design flaw. I don't know, was that an issue in Nicaragua when they did it?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
I assume not, just because I feel like it was like every single goal except one went in, and the one, of course, is Brenda, which I was glad that you didn't get a chance to mock her for, actually, but yeah, it felt like this challenge ended quicker than that one did.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? I guess the mechanics of the challenge aren't really what we're here to talk about, but let's try, this is where the bros win the challenge off with Cochran, and they get to go rock climbing and everything. Decidedly out of Cochran's wheelhouse, as he rarely leaves his apartment and rarely leaves Twitter.
Yeah, you wonder if he just had that, like, if he had that line stored up in the back of his head so that at the ideal moment he could bust out and instantly double his follower count or something.
I don't know if it was planned, but I'm sure when he saw that made air, he was fist-pumping hard. When we talked to Max about this, when he made that comment, he was at 21,000 followers. He's now at, like, 35,000. It's incredible how quickly both he and Malcolm are just skyrocketing.
That seems strange to me, though, because surely, like, if you have a Twitter account and you're that big a fan of the show that you're being inclined to follow one of them on Twitter, wouldn't you have looked for them before that? Like, I kind of imagine this increase is due to people just finding out that he has it.
You know, I think what would be helpful is if to promote Twitter activity, CBS would put little hashtags in the bottom corner so we could know what to be talking about during episodes.
Or not just hashtags. Like, when they have confessionals, instead of the season tagline at the bottom, just have a Twitter handle or something.
I'm sure Cochran would prefer that.
I'm sure he would. And Malcolm as well, actually.
Yeah, so let's get into this, because this is where the bros pitch Cochran, this kind of long-term alliance. And I'll point out, my boy Michael Snow playing along quite well with the bros. I don't think that was necessarily his angle.
But yes, playing this exceptionally well to the point that he gets voted out in the same episode.
we'll be getting right to that. But yeah, any thoughts stand out to you about this scene or off on the reward?
Well, the only thoughts you can have, really, are about Cochran, and that's by design, I think. Like, he has become the narrative voice, not only of all these individual incidents, but of the season as a whole. And I think we're meant to see this through his eyes now. Like, and that's not even mentioning, like, the way in which his part in that reward is edited, right? The inspirational music and the confessional, and, like, this story of personal growth that they seem to be pushing really hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, actually, honestly, now is as good a time to just get it out there as any. I think we are both quite confident that this season is all but in the books, and Cochran has won, and it's just a matter of how.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of when this point rather than if. Like, we didn't really get to make predictions for the past few weeks because we hadn't been recording. We made some at the merge, but I think we were both agreed that it seemed like it was going to come down to a showdown between Malcolm's new alliance and Cochran's existing alliance, and whichever of those groups emerged on top, that person was going to be the by far the front runner. And you know, as soon as Corinne went, it was basically in the bags, I think, and you know, Michael Snow going and then Malcolm going this episode basically locked it up for Cochran, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's mostly a combination. I mean, Cochran said it's been amazing. His game logic-wise, his position is fantastic. I know we're going to have no shortage of talking about Cochran. But mostly for me, it's Dawn's edit's just been deteriorating, too.
I could actually see this being the edit that Cochran would get if he gets rid of it in fourth as a jury threat. But the reason I'm doubtful that's going to happen is I'm not sure who would fill this place as the de facto winner at that point, given that we might think it would be Dawn, but Dawn is turning more and more into a go by the second. So
yeah, and that's crazy. That's wild to me that Dawn would make the finals and lose. I thought since the first time seeing her in South Pacific, but I think that's honestly what we're in store for.
Well, I don't think it's that strange, because we would have said the same thing about Lisa, I imagine, at the beginning of the season, right? Because, yeah, she started off bad, but she seemed to be well-loved to the point that at the merch episode, I was about ready to call it for Lisa, because she had a fantastic episode, great edit, and it seemed like she was both in a great position in the game and well-liked enough to mow down anyone she got to the finals with. And that deteriorated so fast that Lisa was basically drawing dead long and scooping by the end. And similarly with Holly, actually. We would have thought that Holly would be a slam dunk victor as well, but watching her Ponderosa videos, again, maybe this is kind of a unique circumstance, but she probably wasn't going to win until she made it.
Is that, I Nicaragua long since blacked out of my mind. Who was going to beat Holly?
Well, that's the thing. Like, I think she probably would have won over Chase, but it wouldn't have been the jury enthusiastic to vote for her. It would have been, well, Chase is wishy-washy and we hate Saf, so we just give it Holly as a default.
Kind of like exactly how Fabio won.
Basically. Although I think he was more well-liked than that gives him credit for. But anyway, that's tangential.
I guess the difference for me between Don and Lisa is, like, I can really see why people wouldn't necessarily feel, not only not feel comfortable voting for Lisa, but why they wouldn't want to even vote for her in the first place. And with Don, I just don't feel like anyone truly has any kind of actual beef with Don as a person on any level, nor has pretty much anyone she's ever encountered. And I feel like that's a pretty tough obstacle to overcome.
Yeah, I feel like if she does lose, it's going to be because of a lack of respect rather than out of dislike. Like, I don't think people will dislike Dawn. She's someone who is very difficult to dislike, I think. But you know, you have to be able to envision the person as a winner, and someone who's breaking down the thought of having to play the game at all isn't someone that fits into that in that mold.
See, and this may be signaling to me that perhaps at this final tribal council, maybe some jury votes change, because I feel like Dawn would have a lot of support just at entering a tribal council, and if Cochran just blows her out of the water and or she cries and doesn't own up to anything and he's, you know, killing it, I honestly feel like maybe someone could, it could be a situation, I don't think Dawn wins, but I think it might be someone steals it from Dawn rather than someone just outright gets people to vote for them over Dawn as they would have otherwise.
Yeah, Sophie made a good point in her interview, which was that when someone like Dawn betrays you, it stings all the more because that's someone who you feel like you've really committed to, someone who you've opened up to, you can feel comfortable around. And so when that gets flipped on its head, it hurts more than it does if, like, you know, if Malcolm betrays you, you don't really, you hate being out of the game, but you don't feel angry at Malcolm specifically because you realize, firstly, that that's in keeping with what you expect from him. That's the kind of guy he is. He's here to play the game. And also he he's bonded with you on a personal level, but not, you don't view it as, like, an explicit betrayal in that sense.
Right, and this honestly might be how Sophie herself won, which is basically she all but avoided, I think, the Savaies as they were getting picked off. She knew what was going to happen, and she wasn't trying to win over their jury votes ahead of time, and people weren't upset with her for being facetious or whatever. They were like, yeah, you did what you got to do.
It's also worth pointing out that this is a very young cast, especially the people who are left now. Like, let's think about this. So in South of Us, we have Cochran, who's, 25, Malcolm's 25, Andrew's 23, Eddie, I think, is 23, Reynold is early 30s, I believe. The only person I can think of who's comparable to Dawn in age is, there's Sherry, I guess, and there's Michael Snow, but I have to imagine Dawn wants to be sitting there with Sherry, so that doesn't really apply. You know, there's going to be a lot of people who, they don't, like, relate to Dawn in the same way that they do with the rest of their bros. They like her as a person, but now, if that's been tainted by her actions in the game, then they no longer have an active reason to vote for her.
Mm-hmm. Actually, one of the things I've been thinking about is how young Survivor casts tend to be now. I don't like it. I feel like the 30s aren't getting any kind of representation. I feel like that's a very missed demographic.
I feel like it's hard to make that argument coming out of the Philippines, where we had three finalists who are all over 40. Jeff Ken, who is, 43. Penn, who's 50. Like, that was the oldest card we've seen in quite a while.
And that's true, and they did go deep.
Artists even as well.
Totally. But those are the over 40 crowd, and I feel like the demo that they're missing a lot of, they got a lot of young and mid-20s. I feel like the late 20s to mid-30s, which, as we know, is my Survivor, the perfect age range to be a Survivor player, I think. For whatever reason, I feel like half the season should be those kind of, like, young, professional, kind of ambitious people, and we just never see it. We see super young people and older people who have, like, families.
Yeah, I guess the only person in that demographic still in the game is Reynold, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I see your point.
Okay. So let's go on now, I think, to talk a little bit about this Andrea and Eddie, maybe showmance, whatever, because when we saw the preview for this the week before, which was about a month ago at this point, I thought this was 100% just misdirect, Andrea taken out of context, but it turns out that there was actually something kind of going on there.
Yeah, and once again, it gets introduced by this bizarre music that it wasn't exactly the same, but it reminded me of that scene, again, with Andrea in the Merge episode in her first season, where she's talking to Matt, and they were being set up as, like, this couple or whatever. Maybe this is just their, like, is this their default way to edit Andrea? Is this kind of flirtatious, seductive, I don't know.
Andrea is the Taylor Swift of Survivor. This is well established. And this is just another in the long line of Andrea hopeless romances, I think. But this was really, because obviously this partnership, this pair, Andrea and Eddie, that round, a great basically was decided because Eddie ran his mouth to Andrea that she was the one who was going to go. And otherwise, we could have seen a totally different game where if they keep votes on Malcolm and that plays out, and then they still have two idols the next round and everything, we could have seen, instead of Michael Snow go, we could have seen two Stealth R Us go back to back, and this, we could have a whole wide open game here. So I guess bottom point there is, God damn it, Eddie, way to ruin not only your own game, but the viewership's game too.
Right. It's an excellent illustration of just how one seemingly innocent conversation could just mess everything up and have wider ramifications, right? Because if Eddie doesn't spill this to Andrew, what do you think happens there? Like, I ask that, but it's just so difficult to even come up with an answer to it.
Well, I think this is kind of the strategic core of this episode, which is when Stealth R Us has the votes and they can split and whatever, going for Malcolm is, I think, by far the most highly effective play. But when any one of them within the core knows that if Malcolm, if something goes wrong, they're the one who goes, then the boot almost has to shift to Michael and everyone else has to go along with that. So if that doesn't happen, if Andrea doesn't get wind that she's the one who's going to be going, I could easily see the vote staying on Malcolm. And as I said, two Stealth RS going out at 11 and 10.
Yeah, and all credit to Andrea for making that happen, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I mean, this is I was pretty tough on Andrea in the early going of this season. I feel like she's been kind of all over the place and kind of frantic, but the recent episode, she's really impressed me, actually.
Yeah, I like it far more when, if you're criticizing someone, it's for making what we perceive to be a bad move, given what we see on TV, rather than for being a casting mistake. And Andrea, despite what everyone likes to say about her, or maybe because of what everyone was saying about her, I think she's really been brilliant this season. She managed to stir things up at every turn without doing so in a way that comes across as forced or rammed down our throats.
Oh, yeah, this kind of all over the place, frantic is the word I keep using to describe it, is definitely great for TV. I don't know if it's always the best mindset to be playing the game with, but she's taking it and running with it and really getting aggressive about the game. And again, this may be Boston Rob PTSD, but I think it's definitely playing great for the cameras.
Yeah, she has exactly this right mix of like cuteness, awkwardness, and franticness, if that's even a noun, but I don't know, she just seemed like a natural fit, maybe not a natural fit for the game of Survivor, but a natural fit for being on the show Survivor, I think.
Yeah, I'm certainly very happy that Andrea got to come back. I think this is one of the better casting choices, and as we talk, I'm sure we're going to be talking about potential returnees from this cast. I think Andrea as the leading female candidate here.
Yeah, given the shortage of potential viable female returnees, or even amongst the men as well, I think Andrew is someone who definitely could come back. The only problem with that is I'm not sure in what capacity, because if they are going to have another All-Star season, is it going to be themed? If so, would Andrew fit that theme? You know, it's a question, I think, how many seasons the franchise has left in it at this point. So I'm not sure she's going to have an opportunity to return, but yeah, if she's ever in the conversation, she's definitely going to be at the top of the list.
Right. If there is another season that they're casting and they're saying, we want players who haven't played three times yet, but from the last 10 seasons or however far they want to go back, I think Andrea honestly might be number one on that list for females. All right, so pushing ahead, I think the next pertinent thing to talk about episode 9 is actually all the way down at Tribal Council, and this is when the votes are cast. Probst says if anyone has a hidden immunity idol, now's the time to play it. Reynolds gets up to do so. Hold up, bro. And Malcolm stops him and, basically just says, look, they voted for me. And he gets Reynolds' idol from him after casting his own vote for Reynolds, might I add. Actually, we should talk about that. Write that down. And so, let's get into this idol pass. And first of all, my question is, if you're Reynolds here and you're dead set on playing your idol for yourself, I imagine, to get safety, what's possibly going through Reynolds' mind here?
Who even knows what's going through Reynolds' mind? Relentless optimism, maybe? Who knows? The thing is, actually, like, we can make fun of him for being so susceptible to this idea that he's instantly just going to hand over his idol, but I don't actually think it's that bad, because they all know what the situation is at this point. Either they successfully pull off a play with an idol, or they win immunity or whatever, or they're going home, right? It looks like that's said and so, nothing's going to change that. So if they have a suspicion that the target might be someone other than Reynolds, then yeah, okay, you can take the risk and pass it out, though, because, let's say you're wrong about it. Okay, you go out, fine, but you're probably going to go out in next week or in 2 weeks' time anyway. It doesn't change anything.
Yeah, see, this is what I'm looking for now from casting, is people who want to play and people who don't know how to play but still want to play, like Reynolds, who don't really get why they're doing what they're doing but are willing to make these kind of ambitious moves. Not the kind of people who, know what they're doing and just really want to play it safe, which I feel like is an overwhelming percentage of the population here. And I mean, honestly, regardless of the merits here, this was first of all amazing television. Second of all, obviously a phenomenal move by Malcolm getting Reynolds to give up the idol for him. But I Reynolds really has stood out to me as a giant character this season. That I've had a great time watching Reynolds, and this really started sealing the deal for me. I love this. Yeah.
Hold up, bro. I'm not sure I would quite categorize him like that, because we're seeing him having to play from behind after needing to do so for, what, 30 days now? I'm not sure that if, let's say, Mike and Matt had sided with his group at the First Tribal Council and they'd been able to roll over the fans, I think he plays a pretty typical, boring game, to be honest. Like, you know, he sticks with Eddie, he sticks with Ali. You know, maybe there's some debate down the road about whether they take Ali or Hope, but it'd have been a pretty unremarkable path to the end for him, I think. I much more enjoy seeing him when he's in this spot where his back's up against the wall every single week and he has to pull a trick out of his hat.
Right. See, this is the upside to having so many boring episodes where the fans lose is Reynolds. Like, if the fans had gone in and Reynolds' alliance had taken control of the fans' tribe, Reynolds probably gone really early in the jury if the favorites have control there. Whereas because nothing has worked out for Reynolds, he's forced to make great television week after week. And for that, I'm super grateful. And honestly, actually, I was thinking about this in thinking about who might come back from this season. I think Reynolds, honestly, we could see him play again.
Possibly. Who would he be competing against for that slot, though? Like, maybe Troyzan, I think? Because skipping forward to the preview for next episode, actually, it reminds me of the preview for Troyzan's boot episode, where it's like the whole episode is centered around can Troyzan survive, and that's his farewell episode, and then once he's struck down, they just move on with their lives and he's forgotten about.
I would love it if Reynolds would take Troyzan's spot in some of these future All-Star seasons.
Absolutely. Although, maybe this is kind of a spoiler, so if you don't want to know something about the next episode, then mute this quickly, but it is confirmed that next episode is going to be a double boot, so if Reynolds does go at that point, then there won't be much fanfare, just because there won't be any time for that.
I hadn't heard that confirmed, but yeah, that's definitely what we were anticipating anyway.
Yeah, I think we want to touch on that a little later at the end, but yeah,
okay.
Carry on for now.
Let's just get back. I think Malcolm, first of all, I had this, Malcolm potentially getting Reynolds' idol. I want to point that out, because that was a bold call that I didn't think was actually going to happen, but I'm very happy that it did.
You also had Hope, Matt, and Michael competing for domination of the season, so yeah, not going to give you a perfect record here.
Well, okay. Still, I was very much, I'm sure we're going to be talking a lot about Malcolm as a player in general and about his legacy. This, to me, stood out on the level of, like, just to be thinking about that kind of idea really, really impresses me. And I don't even know how much, but plenty more hidden immunity idol stuff to come. We don't need to go back too far on this, but I thought this was really exceptional stuff that I don't think basically anyone would go for. This is on the level of the Black Widow Brigade getting Eric to give up his necklace to me.
Not so much given that it didn't actually work, but just having the sheer audacity to think to ask that and then to actually go through with it. That's the mark of a great Survivor contestant to me, someone who just has the balls to do something like this without... Like, we've had people before who are like so lacking self-awareness that they would just do whatever they want and hope that it works out, like Russell springs to mind. But you have Malcolm, who is a far more smart, cerebral player than that, but who, like, it doesn't translate that into being unwilling to play the game at all.
Oh, right. I think Malcolm is maybe the finest example we've seen of someone playing for first place and first place only, and that is the biggest thing I like to see.
Yeah, Malcolm stands out to me as one of the best casting choices in recent memory, I think.
Malcolm stands out to me as the future host of Survivor. This kid's going nowhere. I'm not joking.
Yeah, I saw that tweet. I saw that Twitter exchange between Probst and Malcolm, where I think Jeff Probst was kind of like just joshing with him. But yeah, it's like Malcolm has acquired a level of popularity that is maybe not unprecedented, because you've had previous people like Rupert and Stephanie who are the darlings of the franchise at one point. But Malcolm is like the modern day equivalent of that. I think his level of engagement with people, especially on like social media, is something I've never seen before. It's at least for Survivor, like it's reminiscent of how, you know how even the most random Big Brother player will get like 20,000 followers or something. Malcolm is just far surpassing everybody else.
I think Malcolm actually just passed Ian Terry in followers, which is why, given the difference between Survivor and Big Brother as they pertain to social media interaction, is just stunning to me.
It's absurd. Like, he's rocketed far above like Russell, who previously was the top dog. I think it's, yeah, I don't know what to think about it.
Yeah,
like, even Ozzy, like Ozzy somehow has like 5,000 followers, whereas Malcolm. Maybe because he's gone to the effort of cultivating this Twitter persona for himself, but I think also just because he is overwhelmingly popular, he's at the top of the standings now.
Oh, yeah, and as far as Malcolm's general popularity as with regard to, like, Rupert and Stephanie, Malcolm is by far the most deserved, I feel, of the super Survivor superstars, short of, like, Boston Rob and Russell Hans, who I think definitely earned their hype. But Malcolm is kind of certainly right place, right time as far as where Survivor is as a franchise, but I think this is a phenomenal casting, first of all, like you said. And I don't see, Malcolm will be back for a third time, and I'm telling you, if Survivor goes to cable or not, Malcolm is top of the list for the next host. I'm promising you that.
It's interesting, actually, that Malcolm has said that he didn't like his edit because he felt like both times he was kind of whitewashed. Some of the more controversial things he said, or like, apparently half of his confessionals in the Philippines were Abby Maria impressions, which we just never got to see any of. Like, they painted him as the golden boy, and obviously that's fed into his incredible popularity. But also it meant that we got a kind of one-dimensional view of Malcolm, that even when he was inclined to respond to situations in this snarky, sarcastic way or whatever, we just never got to experience that.
Actually, staying on Malcolm for a minute here, why do you think he voted for Rennell at this tribal council?
Yeah, this is weird, because I try to think this through, and voting for Reynolds there, if you're Malcolm, is inconsistent with almost any plan you could be trying to execute. So I have to think that this was a spur-of-the-moment thing at Tribal Council, when maybe somebody said something that spooked him, or he wasn't planning to play his idol, but he got this sense that he was in danger or whatever, and he thought, well, if I can help it, I don't have to waste my idol now if I'm going to be in hot seat again next week. So, I mean, who knows? I seem to recall him mentioning this in an interview at some point, which is why it's so frustrating that I can't remember it.
Malcolm voting Reynolds here to me is kind of like the definition of like an all-purpose vote here, which is, honestly, if I'm Malcolm, I try to, I know you know you can't, but I think Malcolm's best play here is almost abstaining from voting, like voting for no one, because he's trying to swing a couple of sides together, but he still has to put his vote on someone and thus indicate to them that he's not fully on board there. And Reynolds, first of all, probably going to be someone, he knows Stealth R Us might be splitting. If it's between he and Reynolds, that puts one more on Reynolds to potentially, not force a tie and not cause for a revote. And secondly, if weird things happen, he can defend a Stealth R Us. Hey, what the hell? I thought we were splitting these votes here.
Yeah, I think that last justification you gave that he can plausibly construct a story for Stealth R Us is the reason, is probably the most likely reason he did it. But I don't think splitting the votes it was a factor here, because it's going to be 4-3 on Reynolds no matter what. So your vote only makes it 5-3, at which point, you know, it's an irrelevant vote, right? Unless maybe he thought that if Reynolds and Eddie were voting for him, and then if he votes for Reynolds, it's 5-5, and Reynolds doesn't play the idol, then Reynolds goes home, and Malcolm gets to keep his idol. That seems very circuitous. I have to mention at that point, he has a good enough read on both Eddie and Reynolds to know that they're not going to act like that. They are going to follow through with the plan, even if it means staying on this sinking ship.
Oh, totally. And I feel like I don't think Malcolm was at any point concerned about not knowing exactly the way that Reynolds and Eddie were going to be voting. I think he basically could dictate at every single tribal council, hey, you guys vote this way and they'll do it. I guess it just goes back to me, like, there's a ton of downside with voting for basically anyone else, no matter how it goes. And when he knows his position is going to be tough entering the next round either way, I think Reynolds is a safe vote. Close to a throwaway vote, but if it's not a throwaway vote, it could make a huge difference for Malcolm.
Yeah, I don't think it's worth speculating too much on, to be honest.
Okay, so Michael's gone. I want to point out, just as we're finishing up on Michael, which is, I feel like Michael, honestly, might have been the greatest missed opportunity of a player that we've had, which, of course, there's no way to know, but I really strongly feel like Michael could have been a really great player, and I was sad to see him go, and I doubt he's going to get another chance, and that's too bad. But cast more people like Michael. Anything else on Michael before we get into the next episode?
I'm just wondering what you think he brought to the season, to be honest.
He has kind of almost like the same thing I think about Denise. The reason I'm so high on Denise, I think, is he really understands what people mean by what they're saying, and he knows what they want to hear, and he's great at playing to that. And I think that is such...
Is he? Like, what evidence have we seen?
The bros off at the reward challenge, just kind of going along with the bros, or going along with Matt at pre-merge and everything.
Well, going along with Matt being, you know, talking to the person who's your closest ally and your best friend, that's not evidence of exceptional gameplay at all. And that thing with the bros at the reward, like, okay, that's just an obvious thing to do. It's not evidence of some great social awareness.
Okay, I guess it's more, I haven't seen anything, you know, I don't like the Laura boot still, I think that was bad, and that's obviously a big issue for me with that entire fans tribe pre-merge, specifically Michael and Matt, who were the decision makers there, but I feel like, just as far as his personality goes, he's a guy who's going to have a ton of success in Survivor, generally speaking.
I don't know about that. I don't see where you get all of this from, to be honest.
Careful observation of people and interactions. I don't know what to tell you. I have an eye for talent, Tom.
It feels like you're making all these like weird, unfalsifiable statements about his skill that he never put on display. And the one decision that he had to make, you just admitted that he botched. So.
Right, but you're the one sitting here trying to falsify unfalsifiable claims, and so I feel like I'm winning.
I'm not trying to falsify them. I'm saying in order to make them in the first place, you need to have some kind of evidence. Like, if I come back at you and say, no, Michael doesn't have that skill, like, are we just supposed to leave that disagreement there, or are we supposed to refer that dispute to evidence?
Okay, it's more, I don't know what it is. It's intangibles. I don't know how to debate this. I just feel like Michael, just his ability to talk to other people and listen and look like he's listening really stood out to me. He knows who at least Ceri and Sester Nino are. I feel like Michael is a well above average Survivor player.
Using this insight into intangibles, what do you have to say about Hope now?
About Hope? Yeah. I might have been slightly off about that.
Or about Matt, let's say.
I still stand by Matt. I think he's the poor man's Chris Doherty. I'll put him there, but I still think it's exactly the same kind of mentality that could easily work on dumb people.
And apparently it has, so.
All right, well done. Okay, let's get into this next week, which is the episode starts. We're not going to get into as much detail as we normally would, but the bros have this kind of meeting now back from Tribal Council where Michael's just been voted out. And this is, I think, where we see them become the three amigos, which is, they're welcoming Malcolm to the bottom, like, hey, Stealth R Us is off having a powwow, and no one talks to us, but it's okay, because we're on the bottom, and they can't really lie to us, we know they're coming, and I actually it's not a free roll, it's the last place you want to be, but it's still a good point, I think, that Eddie makes, which is, you have a lot more room to play when you're on the bottom. I think people are going to be a lot more forgiving.
Yeah, obviously, you don't want to be there, but once you are, it's kind of liberating, in a sense, because you know that you can just you can do and say whatever you feel like you need to do without worrying about the repercussions, because you have a much more immediate set of repercussions, which are you go out of the game if you don't succeed.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And for some people, I think also, like, they operate better when they're backed against the wall, when they're under pressure. And so, and this is like the highest amount of pressure you can be under in a game of Survivor, right? So if Malcolm fits into that category, which I'm not sure he does, but if he does, then yeah, it might not be so bad.
The thing that I was actually curious about here is Malcolm, of course, did put his vote on Reynolds, which we just talked about. But Stealth R Us seemed to have no interest in, like, considering welcoming him back into the group. Is that a misplay, or is it Shep being stubborn, or what?
I don't think it's anything to take notice of. I feel like the lines have been drawn on the sand at that point. Nothing you can say or do is going to change that.
Yeah, okay, I guess it's kind of like if Malcolm feels like they all just voted for him and Reynolds trusted him enough to give him an idol, he's not someone I want to necessarily let back into the core alliance.
Yeah, exactly.
So the preview for this episode was Dawn's breakdown, and we finally get to see what all that was about, which is she lost her retainer, which I think I lost my retainer when I was like 13. It didn't cry.
Fair enough. Basically, in the preview, we heard this bleating goat in the woods in every sense of the word. And it turns out that it's actually, like, it was a fairly anticlimactic incident. Based on how it was presented in the preview, I thought this, like, maybe somebody else had this Brandon-esque meltdown and Dawn was there crying about that or something. It was billed as this big event, and it turned out Dawn's teeth fell in the water, Brenda got them back, and that was the end of it. It just kind of fizzled out.
Right. When I was kept seeing all these promos, I'm idiot that I am, was thinking, oh, God, it's just more Dawn crying. This is so predictable. We're just going to have a boring episode, and they can't show us anything of actual substance on there in the previews.
Yeah, and this is one of the reasons, actually, that I didn't enjoy the episode as much as you probably weren't expecting me to, but probably thought that I should, because it was just so incongruous with everything else. Like, this, you have this one scene with Dawn and then with Brenda, and then yeah, after that cuts out, it moves on to something completely different, and it's never mentioned again.
Right.
I was wondering at the time what the purpose of this scene was, and I thought firstly it was to display this contrast between Dawn and Cochran, because we see him talking to Philip at the beginning, saying like the two of them like discussing Dawn and how she's having this breakdown, and the two of them, even Philip actually looks relatively stable by comparison there. But also, I think this is setting up, given what Brenda said at the end, like, well, you know, Dawn and I never go on to each other now. I thought, well, fuck, that's good. Thanks, Brenda. Thanks for playing. Like, at some point, Dawn is going to knife Brenda in the back, and I am not going to be happy about it.
Let's get into this, actually, because, you know, Dawn loses her teeth. She calls Brenda over because this is a very sensitive issue that she wants to someone quiet, like Brenda, good choice, to take care of. And Brenda finds him. And like you just said, Brenda gave her first confessional. We'll get to the confessionals in a second. Her first confessional in forever about how, like you just said, about how now, like, oh, Dawn and I are totally going to the end together now. Is this something that stands out to you as good Survivor play? And is Brenda Lowe, after seeing what we've seen so far, a good Survivor player?
You really wanted to ask that, didn't you? No, I don't think so. But it is weird because it doesn't feel like she's there to play this time. And this isn't trying to make excuses for her, but it's like that's not the metric that you would have to judge her by, because she's not coming into this one expecting to do well, she's not here to play for first place, it seems.
All right, and fair enough, and I would agree wholeheartedly that she is not a good Survivor player, but a big qualification for being one is wanting first place in my book, and I don't know how you get a return opportunity, and that's the approach you take.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure why she would be there instead, other than just for the experience that she apparently enjoyed so much last time, but...
Well, I can tell you why she's there instead. She's there to set records.
So, Dom, I think let's get into Brenda's historic streak. This is something I've been wanting to talk about for a while. Hit on it a little bit with Max Dawson. Here is the official Brenda Silence stat line, which is she got her first confessional a few minutes into episode, you know, half an hour into episode one. Since then, if you took out all the commercials, you would have watched 371 minutes of commercial-free airtime without seeing Brenda until you get to Brenda's next confessional. This is smashes the previous record. So I desperately got to hear what your take on this.
Yeah, I never imagined. Well, that's a lie. I never hoped that she would be the one to break that record. Coming into the season, a lot of people were expecting that, if anything, Andrew would be the one who was more low key, and Brenda would have the same kind of edit, maybe to a different extent than she had in Nicaragua. Personally, I was always a bit more pessimistic about Brenda's chances. I thought she was the type of person who, if she wasn't in control, could easily get ignored, and apparently that's ended up happening, but to a far greater degree than I could have imagined. I don't know. I'm glad that she gets to be notable somehow this season. If this is going to be her fate, then at least she does it in style, but it just seems like such a waste. I understand the argument that some people have made that it's nice to be able to see two different sides of someone when they come back for a second season. So, you know, we already got to see the ruthless bitch Brenda, now we get to see vulnerable sweetheart Brenda or whatever. But it feels like if that's the dichotomy they're going for, it could have been done in such a more careful way like this. Like, for instance, I think we both agree at this point that Brenda is either going to lose in the finals or going to get booted unceremoniously sometime just before that, right? So let's say she gets booted at Final 5, Final 4 for being a jury threat. It would be much more convincing and far more interesting to watch if we understood why she was being booted for being a jury threat, right? But at the moment, we don't get to see that. Like, we can understand from the little we see of her why people might like her, for instance, but it's just never fleshed out, it's never substantiated.
Right, yeah, and this is, in our preview show, I went really hard on Brenda. I still think she is the biggest imposter as far as Survivor reputation to actual skill set goes, but I gotta say, this is not at all what I was expecting to see when I was so pessimistic out of Brenda, and in her pregame interviews, what really stood out to me is her approach was, or her answer to every question is, oh, I totally learned everything from my last time, I know exactly what to do this time, and I thought she was just gonna get so caught up in the game. Like we've seen Andrea, but even to a more absurd extent, I thought she was going to try to run the show from day one and do it really poorly and be an early boot or be an early post-merge boot if somehow she can make it that far. I did not at all expect to see totally quiet, not at all involved in the game, Brenda. And while I'm happy that I can gloat about how much of a non-factor she's been, it's actually somewhat surprising to me because she does seem like someone who at least, I'm sure she's talking to the camera and saying stuff about the game that has actual impact on what's happening. They're just not showing it, and it's absolutely stunning to me.
Yeah, and her confessionals are good. Like, it's true that given that she's on the periphery of everything that's going on, whatever she's saying isn't directly relevant to the game, but when you need just a filler confessional about the challenge or the reward or something, then Brenda can deliver that if you want, and she can, she's articulate, she's cute. Obviously, she can fill that role as it needs to be filled, and yet they're just handing it off to people who have already monopolized all the screen time.
Right, which is now leading me to think that there's no real reason not to show to deliberately not show her to such an extent. So I'm curious, is it possible that Brenda, the way she leaves the game, like we saw with Purple Kelly, is something the producers aren't okay with, and this is like their punishment?
I was wondering that. She doesn't seem like the type to quit. I thought it's possible she gets medevaced or something, but because obviously she has a knee thing and maybe that escalates into something more, but I don't know. It's weird. There's no... It does feel like it's a conscious effort to keep her under wraps for some reason.
Yeah, and that's the puzzling part to me, is not so much that Brenda isn't a major driving force within the game, but that she's just not showing up on TV at all when she's still there. That's wild to me. And I don't think it's going to be a meta, like we haven't even heard about her knee on the show. We just know about it from hearing about other, you know, hearing from people who were out there talking about it, and we see her with like a buff around it or whatever. But if she were to get medevaced, we would have seen some kind of setup for it by now. I have to imagine at least. Because it's been just when it's such a nagging thing, unless she, you know, suddenly gets appendicitis next week or something. But I could see, honestly, if we're just in thinking about this double boot episode, it would stun me on one hand, but the only real way I could see this edit, like, checking out is if she just decides she doesn't want to be there anymore and leaves at the beginning of a double boot episode, and then the rest is just how we boot Rettle or Eddie.
I feel like the editors have kind of boxed themselves into a corner here, because, like, we know for sure there's going to be a double boot episode, and there's going to be one more episode after that, and then there's going to be the finale. Typically, the first boot in the finale is someone like Brenda, who hasn't really played much of a role in the season. They're someone who's been dragged along that far, finally gets cut loose, and they don't receive much of an edit typically. So I could see her being placed there. But let's say she gets booted before that. She pretty much has to be booted in whatever the double boot episode is, because given the edit she's had, I have no idea how they're going to stretch her being booted out into 40 minutes worth of screen time, unless they have so much other stuff to pack in there.
That's exactly what I was thinking about, this her leaving during the double boot episode under some circumstances. I don't know, maybe Rennell bangs off both immunities or something, and she's just the default Stealth RS boot.
Sure, but let's say that doesn't happen. There still isn't really a good option for them, because let's say Eric's a victim of that instead. Well, again, you're not going to get much out of Eric being taken out of the game, and yeah, as much as they might want to give Rennell a send-off episode or whatever, people can still pretty much predict what's going to happen if Rennell doesn't lose immunity at this point.
I
think everyone can agree on that. And similarly with Eddie. So if any of Rennell, Eddie, Eric, and Brenda are booted in the next 3 or 4 boots or so, it's just going to be boring, right?
Right, yeah, no, exactly. And it's kind of like a top-heavy and bottom-heavy edit this season, where we got so much Shamar, Brandon, Phillip early on, and they aren't going to be endgame players, and then we just have Cochran and Don and Andrea now in the endgame as, like, developed characters.
Because one of my fears about the course the season was taking at the merge, when everyone seemed to be pretty optimistic, was that, well, the other people in the Corinne and Malcolm Lounge are just going to be booted off one by one, and that was going to make for great television. Then after after they were gone, then all the floaters would be picked off, and that wouldn't be great either. And then maybe we'd have some suspense going into the finale, but just as much as you have in any finale, it wasn't going to be anything special. That hasn't really happened, because Malcolm, I think, single-handedly has kept this middle stretch of the season compelling. And we have, we as the audience owe him a great deal of thanks for that, whatever else we might think about him. But now, like, I'm actually enthusiastic that we're going to have some double boot episodes, just because we can get, not the chaff, but, like, we just get all this stuff out of the way and move on to anything else that might be interesting that's left.
I'm really glad that we have a double boot episode coming up, honestly. Like, we need to lose however many people. I'm happy for them to just blitz out these people that are clearly going to be going next, I think, based on edit.
So let's think through this quickly. We're down to 8 now, and we just had episode 11. So we have episode 12 and episode 13. They need to get rid of 3 people. There's going to have to be a double boot. Do you think they can make room for the family episode?
Yeah, I think family visit?
Because I can see, like, let's say Brenda gets booted next. If that coincides with a family visit, then that might actually be a way to get enough stuff together to make an episode out of it.
Right. I think the penultimate episode before finale Sunday, like the finale is episode 14. So we have two, like you just said, we have 2 more to lose 3 people. I think that second to last one will be the family visit with kind of one of those boring boots, be it Brenda, Eric, Sherry, who knows, in there somewhere. But and because of that, I'm now strongly thinking we're going to lose both of the bros in this double eviction or double elimination.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me at all. So I think we almost have to be resigned to the fact that the next 2 or 3 episodes could be quite weak, and that they're just going to be the setup, if you like, for the finale.
Yeah, definitely.
The thing is that I'm not seeing how this doesn't play out in a way that's predictable from this point. Because if this is Cochran's slow death march to the win as we're expecting, then the finale, while, yeah, okay, on a personal level we're rooting for Cochran, it's not going to be interesting in the sense that, well, like, what's going to happen, right? The biggest decision point I can see is if and when Andrea gets booted, because it seems like she is the biggest legitimate threat at this point, as strange as that is to say.
Yeah, I think, honestly, that's the only suspense left for me is whether or not Andrea is the third finalist. Like, whether she gets cut or just loses in the finals. Because, honestly, I don't feel like there's much suspense as far as the result goes is left. And I don't know that I'm with you, basically, I guess, that I feel like these are going to... We've seen the peak of this season, and these next few are going to be pretty standard, I have to imagine, at least. Because I don't feel like there are people either capable or willing of shaking up Cochran and Dawn's kind of... free ride to the end. And just because of Dawn's edit, I don't feel like Dawn can at this point be beating Cochran. I feel like we would have seen some more positive Dawn and far less crying, kind of vulnerable Dawn at this point. And so for that reason, yeah, I feel like we've passed the high point of the season. Granted, it was a very high point in my opinion. But yeah, I definitely am with you. I think these next couple episodes are going to be not that interesting. It's just a matter of whether or not Andrea can make the final three or not. That's the only thing left for me to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, given that you would naturally expect Dawn to beat Cochran, both in the dark and whatever else had happened in any kind of final situation, the fact that they're making this push to present Dawn as this unstable wreck and to make Cochran at the same time palatable to people who maybe didn't like him his first time around, because obviously he was a polarizing character back then, the fact that they're trying to make him this someone who, even if they didn't like him before, they can now respect maybe, as a gamer, that speaks to me. That shows that this is the outcome that we're being set up for.
Right, and I'm not okay with that, honestly. You have people, I don't know if, I feel like Cochran and Dawn are basically, as we've said, locks for the finals here. Dawn is an impossibly easy person to give an overwhelmingly positive edit to, and I feel like they've kind of fallen in love with this idea that we need to have a good guy, we need to have reasons for everything, and I would be much more interested if Cochran, Dawn, and Andrea had all had good edits to this point, which I think they easily could have done. Like, it's difficult to give Retinal a good edit as far as, like, a game potential winner when he just is on the wrong side of every vote. But with these three, I feel like there could be some really legitimate suspense leading into this finale, and they just chose not to go that route with the storytelling. I mean, almost maybe even in an effort to just, like, crown Cochran and make him look as good as possible, because obviously he's now, like, with Malcolm, the darling of the franchise in the season, at least of late. Okay, so I think the next place we want to go is to the personal immunity challenge, which Reynold wins again. Huge, it was the challenge from the Pearl Islands, where they dive under the docks and everything. And Reynold was going to be the target that night by Stealth R Us, but of course no more now that he's got the necklace. And that's so much interesting in talking about Reynold winning the immunity, because that's pretty standard. But I was interested in Philip choosing to sit out of this challenge for the first time ever. What did you think about this?
I'd say story checks out, but his story certainly didn't check out. Like, I can buy that maybe he had some traumatic experience in his youth or whatever, but if that's the case, why would he be willing to hold his face underwater against a grill for, what, like, nearly an hour? Like, surely, if you're that scared of the water, then you wouldn't be willing to do that.
Yeah, I think his excuse there was that he could still breathe, at least, for the first probably 45 minutes or so.
Well, especially since when you're in that spot where you're, like, you're prostrate and your face is against a grill, there has to be this instinctive response from your body that you're about to drown, and there has to be this fear that kicks in there. Whereas with this challenge, okay, you're diving underwater, you're going up again, but that's not, like, you get to come out of the water. You're in the water for what, maybe a minute at a stretch?
I don't even think a minute is, I think like 15 seconds, yeah.
We're talking Philip here, but.
Well, then the other thing is the way the dock was designed, there was like 2.5 feet of actual solid dock on either end, and the middle was hollowed out just to prevent anything like that. You can always just look up and see how to get out instantly. But I do believe Philip that he had a traumatic childhood instance that was a ton like this challenge.
I believe that Philip had many traumatic childhood instances than another way he did.
I'm curious, what do you think I think about Philip choosing to outright sit out of the challenge?
Do I think anything about it? You tell me.
Apparently not. I'll say, I love it. I have been floored for years that people don't do this more often. And I was going to bring this up, actually, in our interview with Fairplay. The only time I've seen anything close to this is this exact same challenge when they ran it in the Pearl Islands. Fairplay made the final round, but then after, like, two laps there, it was totally clear he was not going to win, as it's often very clear to many, many people in many challenges that they're not going to win. And he just stood there and said, fuck it, and just stopped going. I can't believe more people don't do this in Survivor.
Yeah, we see people, for instance, if there's a maze challenge and somebody's clearly head up to stop in the middle of the maze or something like that. But, I'm surprised we haven't seen someone actually explicitly forfeit a challenge before.
Right, especially in challenges where it's super – I have to imagine most people know that entering many, many challenges, they're not going to win. And when it's – like, I think this is super underrated. I love the idea of just outright sitting out of challenges. I think it's – it's obviously people – the problem is people vote based on challenges, and we just don't care at all about challenge performance necessarily as it pertains to the game outside of, you know, the inherent value of being good or bad at challenges. But I honestly feel like declaring yourself to be someone who's just not even willing to put up a fight if they don't feel like they can win is a phenomenal image to have going forward.
I feel like it loses you a lot of respect there.
Okay, that's definitely possible.
I think people can understand if – you don't do bad challenges as long as you're seen to try your best. If you just downright don't participate, then I think that, especially for people who need to win the challenge in order to stay in the game, I think that doesn't sit well with them at all.
I'm sure it sits well with them in the moment, but once they're later on the jury, yeah, it doesn't sit well. I'm so arrogant, I don't even need to play for this, it doesn't matter who wins, I'm still going to be here. I definitely understand the downside to it.
I mean, we saw Reynolds say in the very same episode that he hated the way that Philip sat out there.
Yeah, but I feel like that, I mean, Reynolds is not necessarily the beacon of Survivor wisdom that I'm turning to in times of desperation.
Right, I'm not saying he is, but he's going to have a vote, and people who think like him, like Eddie, are going to have a vote as well, and this is a democratic process, right? You have to appeal to these people.
That's totally true, and again, I'm actually coming around that outright sitting out of challenges perhaps does more harm than long-term good, because people are going to, if you're sitting out, people already know you're bad at the challenges and everything. But I guess I just feel like, and I'm sure this has been a theme throughout all of our podcasts, challenge performance is such an overrated aspect of Survivor, and throwing challenges is usually good when you're in the majority. And I just feel like people don't understand that enough. And I like the impulse to not want to compete in a challenge, at least. I feel like there's more merit to it than people who are blindly, don't ever throw a challenge, it's always bad.
Yeah, as a viewer, it's great to see Philip sit out of this, because just watching him flare around in the water for one cycle and then go swim over the buoy, it wouldn't do anything for us. But yeah, strategically, it's just not a smart thing to do.
Okay, so back at camp after this challenge now, Malcolm has his one idol from pre-merge in his pocket, and because he played Reynolds' idol last time, they're entertaining the possibility that perhaps another idol was rehidden, and the bros are going to go out and look for it. And so are Don and Andrea, as it turns out. And as this all ends up playing out, Malcolm finds it right in front of Don and Andrea and Eddie. And this is a really interesting situation. So what are you thinking about here if you're Malcolm?
Well, I think the first point of interest is that a lot of people were upset that there wasn't an idol for Malcolm to find, because we haven't seen an idol be rehidden under these circumstances since Fiji, I think. And the new standard policy seems to be that if there's an idol still in play, you don't rehide one that gets used at Tribal Council.
Right, exactly. But the problem is, I find with that, is that we have seen it in Fiji, and we've seen something close to it in One World, and where, you know, Troy Zan found Colton's idol. Granted, Colton went out pre-merge, so that may be invalid. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is, we've seen enough different idol rule sets within all of these seasons. I don't feel like it's fair to say that anything is out of bounds, especially when we've seen this exact thing before. I think this is totally fair, and it's more conspiracy about Jeff Probst just liking the bros.
Yeah, like, I feel like a lot of this criticism gets overblown. Even if the idea is to give Malcolm and the bros a fighting chance, I think that's a perfectly thing. Okay, I think that's a perfectly fine thing for production to be doing, because if this hadn't happened, not only do we lose the biggest episode of the season with Philip being taken out, but an endgame which at the moment looks like it's going to be pretty predictable becomes even more so, right? Philip's still there. He gets dragged to the end of the goat. Maybe that actually creates a bit more tension about who's going to be there with him, because there are only two more slots, but you know, that's another vote the South of Us has, so we know that they're not going to get broken up now, and Malcolm, Reynolds, and Eddie get begonged. It's just not interesting. At least this way, there's possibility for things to be shaken up.
Right, and it's not necessarily only Malcolm that we have to thank for this. It's the concept of hidden immunity. The fact that we have hidden immunity idols is the reason that this season became watchable at, once we hit the merge.
In the abstract, I will always understand why the purists object to hidden immunity idols, but as, like, as a matter of empirical fact, I think this is a great example of why they're good for the show, because, they turned what would otherwise be a foregone conclusion in the three guys just being knocked down like bowling pins one by one, and make it into something which it has an element of uncertainty to it, which is what the season desperately needed. Because, like, given the 7 episodes we had pre-merge, which were almost universally derided as being far below expectation, for the post-merge to be just bland, consisting of these guys being shot down in order, that I think that this would go down as one of the worst seasons at this point. For some people, it already has. There's nothing that can change that, but there would have been no hope of redemption for it.
Oh, right. If there are no hidden immunity idols in play this season, we have an extraordinarily boring season where it's after episode one. Once Francesca goes, that's like the end of the season.
Yeah, that would have, it would have made Redemption Island like some epic drama. And that's discounting the fact that given the outcome that we expect, which is Cochran winning the game, it's not going to be some amazing display of strategic skill that we can all admire. It's not going to be some great underdog story that we can root for, or someone like, you know, Tom Westman, where they just run over the game and you have to at least respect the game that they played. I think Cochran's win, however much his image has been rehabilitated by this season, would still, I think at this point we can say, is still going to be unsatisfying for a lot of people. So you need things early in the season to make up for that. And if it hadn't been for this middle stretch of episodes, the season would have been unsalvageable, I think.
Right. And I also think it's like, given the way that they cast Survivor and given how, because of the way, just because there are so many people who, a few that know what they're doing and a lot that are totally willing to just go along, Survivor, if there were no hidden immunity idols 13 years after the first season, would be really, really boring now. And I feel like hidden immunity idols, and again, I totally see why the purists don't like them, but I feel like there's no question that this was definitely a good thing and has absolutely saved this season, as well as many others. There's no Russell Hantz without hidden immunity idols.
Well, some would debate whether that saved it or not, but in any case, the fundamental flaw of Survivor as a game, or not as a game, but as a game as it translates into a show, is that the correct move for most people at most points is going to be to not shake things up, to keep things the same, and to stick with the plan, and that doesn't make for good TV. It just simply doesn't. So if the game itself isn't going to be entertaining, you need to find that elsewhere, so in good character development, for instance. And you can't get that with the type of people that are casting nowadays, and possibly with the type of audience that the show has nowadays. So I understand the objections to them, but at the same time, I can understand why the producers feel they need to keep the game, need to keep reinventing the game with things like idols or returning players or whatever it may be.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, like you said, even if everyone on the island is rational thinking, playing for first player, as you said, that's going to result in a ton of really boring episodes if there aren't other variables that the people on the bottom can get into. Like, we're basically turning Survivor from checkers, where you can, once you take an advantage, you can just start picking people off, to like backgammon, where no matter how bad you have someone, they're at least going to have outs on the backside.
That's a great analogy, actually, which I thought about first.
All right.
Sorry, Karen.
Okay, yeah, sure. So let's get into this tribal council now, because is this the best tribal council of all time?
No, not even close.
Okay. I thought that might have been your answer.
I mean, what were you expecting me to say? Right?
I feel like it's close. I feel like it's certainly one of the more memorable, and it's high up there.
I feel like it's novel, but I don't think that it was, that given that it was particularly interesting. Like, if, let's say this has happened again, I feel like whatever happened in that other tribal council would be probably more interesting than this one.
Really? Even with Philip being the one who ends up going and the way that the reveal?
I feel because Philip was the one who ended up going, I think people overstate the drama of this episode because this big focal point of the season gets taken out. And I think just so many people were so eager to see him go that they took this episode more than it was. But when you look at it, like, what really happened? The sprint play of the season poll basically spoiled the episode for us already, because we knew that there was no way any of the bros were going home after that. So we knew one member of South Arthur was going to go home. We've seen Eric's going at the start, and then Malcolm's the tribal council basically point to Philip being the one to go home, and Philip didn't even put up a fight. He basically fell on his sword, saying, I'm willing to accept the consequences of sticking with the plan. If it ends up being me, it was him. He walked out, great. But, you know, it could have been so much more, and it wasn't.
See, I feel like that's honestly not only this episode. I think Malcolm's move with the idols could have been so much more, and it wasn't. Granted, it's super flashy, hard to pull off. Good on him for getting both idols and everything, but I feel like he, given that he has two idols, massively dropped the ball here.
Yeah, definitely. So we can get into that now if you want.
Oh, yeah, sure. So let's talk about what Malcolm did do, I think, first, and then we'll talk about what I think he may have been better off doing.
Sure.
Okay, so Malcolm pulls out both idols at Tribal Council and says, hey, you know, at least for now, the three of us are all safe, none of us are going home. And one of you sevens of Stealth R Us is about to go, assuming that, you know, obviously they're assuming they're going to play the idols and everything. And the biggest issue I have here is they announce that they're going to vote for Philip and then do go through with voting for Philip, which not only ends some of the suspense, but also I think is a big time misplay.
Yeah. So, well, this is interesting, actually, because I know when we discussed this a few days ago, you said you'd come around to the logic behind voting for Philip. So have you changed your mind again since then or what?
It's not so, well, this is what happened. At first, I hated the idea of targeting Philip. I've since talked myself, as I often do, into reasons why I actually don't mind it, which is when we were talking about why this season would have been so boring, it's because everyone was trying to bring Philip to the end again. And when you remove that person who's in everybody's endgame plans, when the goal with these two idols, which I think it should be, is to cause as much long-term damage as possible within Stealth R Us, changing everyone's endgame plans drastically is a good way to do that.
Okay, so there are two elements here. The first is who the target should be, whether it should be Philip or somebody else, and the second is the execution of that once you've decided who's on the chopping block. So let's talk about Philip being the target first. I see what you're saying, where everyone wants to take Philip to the end, and now that he's not there, everyone has to reevaluate their plans. But at the same time, I think that might actually work the opposite way that you're suggesting, because everybody knew that everyone wanted Philip at the end, and so... Like, let's say you're Andrea, and Cochran and Dawn are telling you that they want you at the end. At the back of your mind, you always have to be thinking whether they really want you there over Philip, who's going to be a guaranteed win for them, right? And
okay.
The same goes the other direction as well. Like, Andrea and Philip have been tight since the very beginning. If you're Cochran and Dawn, you have to be imagining that she wants to break you two up at some point and drag someone like Sherry with her to the finals, because if it's, like, Andrea, Philip, and Sherry, it's a done deal. So, given that everyone wants Philip at the end, and everybody knows that, there's always going to be that lingering tension there. Now that he's gone, it's perfectly natural for the three of them, so Cochran, Dawn, and Andrew, to say to each other, look, we may as well go to the end together, and for them to be sincere in believing that.
Right, but I feel like at least you can be spinning to people that are on the top that I think are listeners, which is an important thing, is they'll listen to you if their game is totally shaken up. Which is, I don't know why those three would all want to go to the final three together. I think any of them would have a much better chance of beating anyone left in the field.
I'm not sure that's true, aside from Sherry, who I think is still the wild card here. Because let's say you go to the finals together, right? You know that any argument that the others can make against you, you can also make. Which, that does work the other way as well. Like, you can't make any unique arguments because the others can make them as well. But at the same time, let's say you think you can argue your case convincingly. It's much better for you to go up against people who have the same arguments to make but can't make them as well than it is to go up against someone like Eddie, for instance, who, even though he hasn't played a big role in the game, is still well-liked and who would have a pretty compelling underdog story if he were to make it to the end. Like, you see what I'm saying?
I definitely do. I feel like I should restate that the way I'm approaching this situation when I'm in Malcolm's shoes, if I have these idols and I know we have potentially enough immunities now to cover us, as I said, I'm trying to do lasting damage that lasts at least until the next round. And I feel like Malcolm almost owned up to the fact that his plan didn't account for that when he said at Tribal Council, like, the three of us are safe tonight, but when we wake up tomorrow morning, it's going to be back to them all in charge. I don't feel like that had to be the case at all if he had taken a different approach here. And we'll be getting to the actual execution again in a second. But again, I just feel like when you're Malcolm here, if you can pull this off and if you can end up making it to the finals, I feel like it doesn't matter who you're there against, given what you've done in this game, the odds you've overcome, the moves you pulled off, you're going to win or you're going to lose no matter who you're up against, I think. And for that reason, I feel like booting Philip here, one, gives fewer people endgame options, and two, I like leaving in the people that are going to be receptive to working with me and understand that their game is drastically shifted.
Right, I agree that Malcolm wins if he makes it to the end no matter what, but that's not what's at issue here. It's whether, given the knowledge that Philip can't win if he makes it to the end no matter what, how that knowledge is going to affect the long-term plans of Andrea Cogdon and Dawn, and the way in which other people perceive those long-term plans.
Okay. So who are you going for if you play the idols the way that Malcolm ended up playing it?
Well, hold on for a minute, because there's an interesting question here, because I can understand Philip being the target if the objective here isn't to break up South of Us, but to be able to keep both of your idols. And this, in fact, is a plan that Malcolm seemed to want to go for. In his post-game interviews, which this is one of the benefits of doing this so late, which is we get access to all of this extra information, he said that the original plan going in was to take out Philip and publicly announce it, which is why he did what he did, in order that somebody would flip to vote out Philip, you know, being scared for their own safety, and they would be able to keep both of the idols. But that plan all went awry when Eric called them out, as we saw on the show, saying, guys, this could be a bluff, right? They could be doing exactly what Malcolm was in fact intending to do. And that spooked him, and he ended up playing the idols and so on.
Okay, see, I guess fundamentally then I differ from Malcolm, which is when I'm in this situation, I'm not sitting on these idols. I'm trying to do damage. I'm trying to change the game substantially to the point that I have room to play starting the next round.
Right, but one thing that misses is that if you keep both of the idols and one of your group wins immunity, you can put them in exactly the same situation the next round and cause even more damage in the process.
Right, I understand the upside to keeping the idols. I just feel like, and I even acknowledge that both aren't going to get rehidden and there's no way to have enough immunities to cover all of you the next round. I'm not trying to keep getting enough immunities. I'm almost 100% of the time going to be playing the idol, given that I revealed it at Tribal Council, which is why I think that's the big issue that I take with Malcolm, which we're getting into shortly. But yeah, sorry.
Yeah, but keeping both the idols also gives you a lot more options. So next round, let's say one of your group doesn't win immunity, you can't go for that gambit anymore. You might think, well, we're already down to what? It would have been 9 people then. I can just make a run at this now. I have 2 idols. Let's say I can pull off some magic here to make sure I get through this tribal council again without having to play one. Now I'm at the final 8 for 2 idols. I'm pretty good at challenges. There's a good shot that I can actually run the table here.
Okay, one very nitpicky thing that I'm making again about Malcolm is I'm not handing Eddie the necklace and putting it around his neck. I'm going to keep it on my person just in case I pick up some kind of read or whatever. I'm not trusting Eddie with this if things are going
to
change.
Yeah, if you're committed to this plan, I think it kind of makes sense because if you just say, I have another idol, there's still some doubt in people's mind, I think, whether you would actually give it to Eddie rather than keep it for yourself. When you physically hand it over to Eddie, there's a finality about that which makes it clear that you're actually going to go through with this.
See, I would feel like if I'm going to keep both idols, I'd be far more inclined if I'm going to keep them to myself before the votes are cast and then decide whether or not to play them, as in don't hand one to Eddie, I think I'm far more likely to play one on exactly Eddie. I feel like if you don't hand Eddie an idol, he will get 4 votes.
Okay, that's interesting. Another thing which factors into this actually is we saw that scene when Andrea was trying to coordinate how to split the vote, but just before tribal, and she said on the revote it's Eddie, which I was trying to parse that because I was thinking is this edited in such a way that we're missing the context here? Like on the revote it's Eddie maybe she was assuming that one of them would play an idol, and then the revote would be, you know, 3 votes on Eddie and their 3 votes on one of South of Us, and then on the revote they vote for Eddie. That probably doesn't need to be said, but maybe they just wanted, you know, to make that clear. But maybe what they're actually going for is to take out Eddie for some reason. Who knows?
That was my interpretation, and it definitely stood out to me as not the call. Go for Malcolm if you can.
Yes, okay. I agree.
So in targeting Philip, the most popular reasoning I'm seeing is that Philip, when you're looking for someone to flip, is an easy guy to flip onto. Obviously, you know, he rubs a lot of people the wrong way. What did you think about this as the basis for that vote?
I agree with that reasoning, and it's the same reasoning that we've used in the past to argue that Philip would be the right target when you need other people to flip. The problem is, well, I say the problem. It depends, though, on whether they're planning to use the idols right now, because let's say they're planning to use both of the idols. you know, they've determined either that they want to do it or that they have to do that. If that's the case, then they know that the three of them are safe, so you emphatically do not want Philip to go home this round, because next round, because next week, you're not going to have the protection of those idols. You're still going to need to get someone to flip, and it's much easier to do that if you have Philip there as an incentive for them to do that. This is the one time where you have complete control over who's going home if you use the idols, so you need to use that to get out someone who's not Philip to set yourself up for next week.
What do you think about the idea of using Philip and announcing Philip and announcing a target in general of trying to, because I like the idea in general, trying to get someone to flip this vote to expose themselves as not fully on board with Stealth RS?
Again, I agree, but announcing it in the manner they did is completely antithetical to that. Because let's say you're at the core of Stealth RS. You have to be fearful that if they were trying to take out a power play, it would be one of you. So if you're Andrea or if you're Colvin, you have to be at least a little bit scared here. But when they publicly announce it's going to be Philip, all of a sudden you don't have that to worry about anymore. So you can afford to do what Philip said and stick to the plan in knowledge that if it does all go wrong for you, at least you're not going to be the one who suffers from the blowback from the idol. Now, let's say you're on the periphery of South of Us, so you're Eric or you're Sherry or you're Brenda. Even if you want to take out Philip and you can cast your vote for him this round and that's fine. You have a good excuse to bring back to the rest of South of Us after this, right? That you had no choice. You knew that those three people were going to be safe. They said they were voting for Philip, so why not? But, for instance, Brenda seems to want to get out Andrea this round. Now, Brenda has to know that there's absolutely no point casting a stray vote for Andrea, even if that's who she wants to go home, because these guys have already said they're voting for Philip. If she votes for Andrea, then Andrea's not going to go home, and that vote's going to stick out like a sore thumb, and Andrea's not going to be happy about it. So, basically, then, no matter where you are within South of Us, unless you're Philip, when Malcolm announces that the three of them are voting for Philip, that's perfect for you, and it's going to make you less likely for you to flip. So, given that, it seems very strange that they would want to do it that way.
Right, exactly. And this is, I've already mentioned having problems with execution. I think this is probably the biggest mistake, or among the biggest mistakes Malcolm specifically made, which is announcing Philip is fine. It's one thing if you're then not going to vote for Philip and you can just let people pile on and see how many people are willing to save themselves and vote Philip out. So announce, like, I very much like announcing Philip as a bluff, but I don't like announcing Philip and then going and actually voting for Philip. Because you're giving, basically in announcing anyone, you're giving people an excuse to vote for whoever you've announced.
Yeah, and also, if you announce the identity of your target, you're giving that person an opportunity to get votes together onto somebody else. So if you announce you're going after Philip, Philip has a chance here to corral all these votes together against Sherry or Brenda or whoever. Like, if you give him that window to get it together, then they can still vote as a unified block other than the person that they're going to vote out, and nothing's really changed going forward.
Right, and do you think that maybe, because I'm sure part of what crossed Malcolm's mind is Philip seems like a likely candidate. Granted, he almost did the opposite in kind of advising everyone to stay the course, but I could see someone like Philip standing up at Tribal Council upon hearing that he's the target, not being okay with that, and calling everyone in his own alliance out. Like, I want this one out, and then maybe people will put up a fight about that, and then maybe that's one way to get some dynamics open and in the air that you can manipulate later.
Yeah, in fairness to Malcolm, I think he maybe expected a bigger reaction from Philip than he got. It was weird, Philip, because they basically said, Philip, we're voting you out if this all goes well, and Philip was like, yeah, okay, bring it on. You'd expect Philip to just completely self-destruct when he heard that, but he was remarkably composed, almost too composed, actually. Like, he didn't put the work in to try and save himself.
It was crazy to me. Like, I mean, maybe Philip's entire Survivor plan since he stepped foot on Survivor 22 Redemption Island was, like, create this Stealth R Us thing, and that's going to be his thing in every season he plays. And he's a central role in Stealth R Us, and it's going to be an icon within Survivor. But when that's out the window, like, he is just that set on that being his thing and his idea. And I think you're right that his reaction was completely not crazy to me in the sense that Philip's normally crazy. It was so not crazy that it's crazy for Philip. You know what I mean? Like, I could definitely see, while I don't think necessarily that going for Philip, and I certainly don't think announcing him and then going for him is the call, I certainly acknowledge that Malcolm probably had a different kind of reaction in mind, and he got pretty, it's hard to call it unlucky, but I could definitely see not anticipating that at all.
Yeah, so if you do like this idea of announcing who you're going to vote for, I feel like you have to announce that votes are going to be cast on more than one person, because then not only do those two people have an incentive to try and scramble against each other, but everyone else is forced to pick a side.
Right. It's like if you announce, and this is, I think, a plan that I very much like, is announcing three different people. And actually, just to get this out of the way, are you on board that if you're Malcolm here, no matter what happens at this tribal council, as you all are just about to vote, you are 100% capable of saying, Reynold, you vote person X, Eddie, you vote person Y, public in a public forum, and they will do it 100% of the time. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. It's come out in Malcolm's interviews that he only found the idol and was therefore able to engineer all of this only about 45 minutes before tribal council, so he had a lot to do in that time. It's understandable if he didn't have all of these backup plans in place. But yeah, if you have the time to do it, you certainly go in with a plan A, but with the knowledge that, you know, you can say a word or something and the other two will have the knowledge to switch to plan B or plan C.
I feel like you could even be just crystal clear and after getting all of the dynamics as you're about to vote, literally just tell Reynold and Eddie who to vote for, who to put their votes on.
I wasn't really paying much attention to this, but apparently Philip was seated away from the group, away from everyone else who he would need to discuss with, which means that, like, if he needs to suddenly get things together at Tribal Council, it's going to be much harder for him to do it. Which you wouldn't think would normally be an issue, but in this case it is.
Right, and that's like when we saw Brenda say to Dawn, oh, let's go for Andrea. She's like, how can I get that through there? Because Andrea's directly next to me, and the only people who would do it are between – Andrea's right between us. We don't have a way to communicate that. And one thing I actually noticed – it took me a while to notice this. I'm pretty sure Philip, even dating back to Redemption Island, has always sat in that far left seat. And my theory is so they can get a full camera on him with no people also in the background. They can get like a solid profile shot that doesn't have to go – between people, but it's certainly, yeah, in this situation, I think probably for the first time ever, like physically where you are sitting at Tribal Council, but it could have potentially played a giant role in this.
Yeah. So going back to various voting combinations then, I think the issue with announcing like two or more different targets at Tribal Council, so if Malcolm says, okay, we're voting one vote on Andrew, one vote on Dawn, one vote on Cochran, go, then the issue is that those three people can just say, look, we don't want it to be any of us. Let's just have the three of us vote for Sherry or Brenda or whoever. And then that's at least none of us are going home then. If they're smart, that's obviously what they do.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But I also feel like you could then be using that kind of that exchange in the next round that you're definitely going to be at. Like, look, these three were completely unwilling to turn on each other. How long do you think that's going to be the case for? Probably the whole time. So, yeah, and again, it comes down to my base goals, which is make cracks visible to people and hope that they are willing to take advantage of it.
My issue with that logic is that if there's one person who the whole group agrees is on the bottom, you know, erroneously or correctly, then if that person is the one who gets all the votes moved onto them, then other people have no reason to be suspicious. So let's say everyone agrees that Sherry's in seventh. If Cochran, Andrew, and Dawn all say, well, let's just vote for Sherry, and everyone else does it, then that, again, that doesn't cause people to question their assumptions.
It at least opens the door for Malcolm to play his idol on Sherry and Eddie.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, and actually, along the same lines of something you just mentioned, I think a big obstacle to overcome, just given the makeup of the majority alliance, is it's very realistic when six of them are favorites and Sherry has just joined that. And this is probably what Philip should have done, just stood up and say, all right, we're all going on Sherry. Granted, and again, you can combat this with the idol potentially, but it's not a situation where these seven have been so tight the entire time, and now they have to vocally announce potentially someone that they're going for when it seems like it's very clear who the seventh would be in this situation. Like they have an auto-default boot here. Mm-hmm. So I think an important thing to actually be getting into, which Eric rightly pointed out, Survivor Genius Eric at Tribal Council, is they didn't necessarily have to play these idols. What are you thinking about in terms of trying to find a line here where you don't have to play at least one of your idols?
Okay, I'm thinking that if I'm able to keep both of them, or if I play one and then it gets rehidden and I can find it again, then if one of my three wins immunity, we can present them with exactly the same conundrum next week. And that's the ideal scenario, because you, like, It's I think it's unlikely to work once. Like, one of the reasons I'm hesitant to criticize Malcolm in too strong terms is because I don't think he really had a good play here. But if you can do it twice, I think you can really cause some serious damage. That's obviously the dream scenario. It's difficult to make it come together, because not only do you somehow have to keep both idols here, but other things need to go right next week. But that's something to keep in mind. if I don't have any idols, then next week I basically have to rely on flipping at least one person, right? Which means whatever I do here has to have serious consequences. I guess you could maybe argue that if you have one idol in play, people might be less reluctant, people might be more reluctant to flip because, like, there's no chance of you being able to use it to avoid a vote split, but at the same time now, if you flip over and team up with them, you're going to have to deal with the issue of the idol later, right?
Right, and I feel...
They play it. So it might be that actually there's not really any advantage to having exactly one idol.
The advantage, other than if they're going to rehide the idol that you did use, there is that advantage that you could still have two, because they're not going to rehide
it. Yeah, but then you need to find that, and then... Either one of you has to win immunity, or you have to pick the two correct targets that they split the vote on, and it's just it's difficult. It's just not that realistic, I don't think.
Right, and I feel like actually a big underrated aspect in debating these kinds of lines is making your play down the road easier. Like in poker, like you want to make a decision on one street in the hand. Sorry if we're talking about poker. But you got to know what you're going to be doing based on what comes down the line. Like if you want to have a plan depending on how things go either way.
Yeah, it's already unappealing enough for people to try and flip over to you because, you know, you're three likable, strong guys led by someone who's clearly incredibly strategic and charismatic. You don't want to make that any harder for them by having to think, well, not only do I have to compete with these guys, I also have to compete with them while they have an idol. At the same time, though, you might think, well, that's never going to get any easier. Those worries are always going to be in place. We may as well have an idol to maybe try and entice people over. It's not something which definitively works out either way.
Yeah, and it's pretty brutal, too, that Malcolm, Eddie, and Reynolds are already a threesome that are presumably going to be pretty tight through the end, so it's hard... Honestly, for people to really want to flip onto that threesome off of their majority alliance when it feels like, if I'm not getting taken, I'm not getting taken either way, and now I'm just burning jury votes.
Yeah, one thing I'd really like to know is, when Malcolm was making his pitch to Sherry and whoever else he made it to, how strongly he intimated that he'd be willing to turn on Eddie and Reynolds? Because I think, firstly, he should be willing to turn on them if he needs to, although maybe, I think he beats both of them, so that's less of a concern. But, like, he has to at least convey that that's something he's willing to do, right?
Oh, totally.
Like, if the three of them sit together, it's game over. You're not getting past that. So why flip into a situation where you're not actually improving your position?
Right, and there's also the added downside of the three hardest people to beat in challenges, although Cochran might take offense to that.
Yeah, and also, it's a very easy sell. Like, if Malcolm goes to them and says, look, Eddie and Reynolds have been together since the beginning. They'd have a great underdog story if they made it to the end, and they're both incredible in challenges. I don't want to go against that. That's a very easy sell. Like, it's believable, and it's believable because it's true.
Right, and actually, this is such a complicated situation, first of all, but I feel like there's a ton of value in actually losing one of Reynolds or Eddie, because if you want, like, people need to feel motivated to keep you and whoever you want to be in the finals with, obviously, in the game. And for the reasons we just said, that's not going to happen when all three of you are in the game under pretty much any circumstances. So I feel like to make a long-term flip where you have an easy path to the end, it's almost good to lose one of them.
Right. So it seems like the decision is weighted towards either using both idols now for maximum damage or keeping them both and try and work the same scenario next week, right?
Right.
If you're trying to keep both of them, how do you go about doing that?
I'm not keeping both of them.
Okay, fine. But let's say you were, hypothetically. Like, so if you were forced to argue for this line, what would be your method of doing it?
For the line of keeping both idols?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. High risk, high reward is the only,
how would you go about actually executing that?
Oh, I see. Oh, my God. The short answer, and I don't know if this is where we want to be getting into next, but certainly I'm not playing these idols at Tribal Council. I'm not revealing them then. I'm revealing them back at camp as soon as I found that second idol.
Agreed. I don't think there's any way you can...
There's no way that you can sit on both.
You'd have to have one of, like, Eric or Brendan or Sherry secure and willing to flip before you could even entertain the thought of doing that.
Right, that's what I mean. I need to know that people know that they're on the bottom and are willing to vote with me for sure this round if I'm going to sit on that on idols.
The thing is, though, if you announce it at camp, then they can split the vote in such a way that it's like three on Eddie, three on Sherry, let's say. Because then, no matter what happens, If it's a revote, they can vote out Eddie. If you use both idols, they can vote out Sherry. Like, it's just, they, what, if you announce it in advance, and we'll get onto this in a second, one of the main reasons I don't like it is there is always a way for them to hedge against any negative outcome.
Right, and that's a risk I'm fully willing to take when we get into it.
Okay, so I guess the way to keep both idols then would be you announce it either way in advance or just in advance of Tribal Council. You hope that there's enough chaos caused such that there's not going to be a split vote. You pile three votes on someone. You definitely can't split them if you're going to keep the idols. And you hope that a fourth vote comes on that person.
Right. It's hope to run good if you want to keep both idols.
So, in other words, actually, you do pretty much what Malcolm was planning to do before Eric indirectly, unintentionally fucked it up.
Was Malcolm planning on sitting on idols?
Yeah, he was. He said he was going to keep both the idols. He said he would probably have a hard time convincing Eddie not to play after he'd just given it to him, but he was willing to take that risk and hope that someone else would flip and vote out Philip, which is weird because Eric is the one who called this plan out and made it not happen, but at the same time, Eric's the one who actually cast the fourth vote for Philip. So
it's classic Reichenbach right there. Yeah, that's definition Eric. So, but again, it's given that I'm showing them at Tribal Council, there's virtually no way I'm sitting on both ever. I can't believe Malcolm, that was his plan.
Maybe actually, I'm not crediting Eric for thinking on this level necessarily, but let's say Eric really wants Philip gone and he wants to vote for Philip himself. If he casts a vote for Philip and this doesn't go through, then like he just screwed himself basically. Whereas now, if he says that at Tribal Council, they know that they have to pay the idols, which means his vote for Philip is guaranteed to be in effect. Maybe. Also, it means if he's trying to set up a flip later down the road, he doesn't have to contend with there being two idols there anymore.
See, thought process like that is not classic Reichenbach.
No, it isn't. But it's a conceivable thought process, right? Like, for someone in that position. Whether or not he comes up with that on the fly at Tribal Council is another matter.
So if we want to look more at the possible methods for using these idols, potentially keeping them, potentially playing one or two, I think, and this is what if I'm Malcolm here and I have these two idols, the second I find that second one, I am not waiting till Tribal Council to show people. I am flashing both to everyone who will look, and I'm trying to get the Stealth RS Alliance freaked out before Tribal Council. And 45 minutes is not a good amount of time, but it's not the worst amount of time. I think like 5 hours is the worst amount of time or more.
What's the benefit? Okay, what are the upsides and downsides of having a certain amount of time for if you're south of us, right? Because I guess your idea is that you want them to scramble, but you need them to have enough time to scramble. What's your idea here?
Okay, my idea is I want everyone to be congregated. We all know we're going to vote in an hour or two or so. And then they find out that this vote is not going to go as they planned, and they are now forced if they want the new vote to go their way, they kind of have to break off. They can't all seven sit there and talk. And so every single conversation that happens, I'm hanging out at camp. I'm drawing attention to as many different people talking to everyone else who will listen. I'm trying to force as many pairs that may not even exist, political alliances that may not even exist, sub-alliances, et cetera, to try to just make everyone super paranoid that it's them. I'm putting on a spectacle here. And I'm dead serious.
I love the idea, just to introduce this element of chaos into the game, but how likely is that to have the desired result, do you think?
I feel like, what are they going to do? I feel like Cochran, Dawn, and maybe Andrea kind of have to go off and talk, and Shep have to figure out what they're going to do. Eric, it's banking on people being willing to acknowledge what they see, interpret it, hopefully for my benefit, which I'm hopefully going to just be propagandizing the hell out of them about what people are saying when they're not there. But I feel like any conversation in that 2 hour period that someone's not a part of, that they're aware of, is going to have at least potential political ramifications that I can use to my favor down the line.
I would be much more enamored with this plan if you had this crack team that was able to go out and do that. Because as it stands, if I see somebody talking to Eddie or whatever, I know that Eddie's acting on behalf of Malcolm, right? Eddie's taking orders from Malcolm. So if I see someone talking to Eddie, I'm not scared that Eddie himself is going to be like trying to manipulate them to do something in particular. I know that everything from that side is going through Malcolm. So if everyone could like come to this implicit agreement that we just don't trust Malcolm because this is exactly what he wants, then it's much harder for him to try and shake things up then because they know that he's someone you just can't listen to.
Right, but in the, for the time being, there's nothing they can do about it, and they have to do something. If they, like, they're not just going to hang out for 2 hours. They're going to talk to each other.
Right, but it only takes a short, like, 2-minute conversation for the four people at the center of South of Us to get together and say, well, we're fucked if this goes through, so let's just play it safe, vote for Sherry, it's done.
Right, and I'm hoping that anyone who did not themselves come up with the name for the boot feels like they are not on top and they are vulnerable. Like, I feel like 2 hours to an hour is like the perfect amount of time.
But see, this is like that goes against the idea of the plan, because your idea here is to make things unpredictable, to shake things up. People in those circumstances will understand why their voice is not given the weight that they think it should, because no one knows what's going on, right?
Right, but I feel like when you're in a raw situation where it's like, hey, you might as well be down to Final Seven and the three of us don't exist, this is a sneak preview at how that's going to play out. And fortunately for you, you still have three more people where if you don't like what you see, you can come with us for the next rounds.
Maybe. I feel like another argument against it, though, is that once you've started it, not only do you have to put this full-court press on everyone to make things go the way you want, but it's you can't put the genie back in the bottle after this. Like, if you come to some conclusion that, like, maybe you want something different to happen, you can't do that because you've just unleashed this terror.
Well, I also feel like you're right. There, a lot can go wrong, and it's likely that the people, the core of Stealth R Us, can get their target boot, and it's unlikely that the people on the bottom are necessarily going to be flipping to you the next round. But you're at least giving yourself outs for that. And I think this is also a critical thing, is you're giving yourself outs to keep idols. If you feel like you can have something going, or you feel like before Tribal Council, that's why I'm saying if I'm playing them both at Tribal Council, if I'm revealing both at Tribal Council, and I'm still probably playing them, that
is high risk. Like, if you're making it so that nobody has any clue what the fuck is going on, then can you get away with not playing your idols? That would be an incredibly ballsy thing to do. And if it works out, then you look like a genius. But if it doesn't, you look like an idiot.
No, but I feel like that's at least anything can happen in those 2 hours, especially with this crew. And for me, if I'm revealing these at Tribal Council, I'm playing both every time. Here, I'll at least consider keeping one. And I feel like keeping one is generally all right.
Okay, so if you're taking this approach, do you actually have a desired boot in mind, or is it anyone that isn't the three of us?
It's, well, obviously it's not going to be any of the three of us. It's, my desired boot is going to be based solely off of my interpretation of what's happening at camp and how I feel the other people would best respond to that. Like, I'm happy to let them talk it out and come to their consensus boot, and because surely every member of Stealth R Us is going to talk to Cochran, Don, and Andrea, and they're going to have to lie to a couple of them or whatever. Like, I want, let the dynamics present themselves and then go from there. Like, play it by ear totally.
Again, like, if you had three players of Malcolm's caliber being there to coordinate amongst themselves the chaos that they were going to induce in everyone else, I would love this idea. As it is, though, you need more skilled operatives, as Eddie would say, than Eddie and Reynold.
And that's definitely fair, but I feel like on the flip side of that, I'm not too worried. Like you said, when people talk about Eddie, they're not going to take him seriously. I'm not so much talking about people talking to Eddie and Reynold. I'm talking about them Stealth R Us talking amongst themselves. That's really what I'm trying to make happen.
Right. But the problem is that the people at the core of that group are at the core for a reason. They're the most well-connected people. It's unlikely that once you reveal this twist that, you know, Eric, Brenda, and Sherry are suddenly going to snap out of their coma and become game bots.
I feel like it's not totally out of the realm of possibility that Shep calls a meeting as he's wont to do, where he says, okay, my alliance come over here, everyone else is uninvited. I could see him having this, like, quick debriefing with a few different people, and I feel like that could cause some suspicion. And, again, the only priority here is, I know we're going to make it through this round, assuming I play both idols at least. I want something there to start next round, and I'm trying to give them as much time to make as many mistakes as possible, I guess, and then hopefully maximizing based on what they do.
All right. So one other line you can take, I think, is you being Malcolm, of course, who, like, we're looking at it through his perspective, I think, because he speaks and acts on behalf of this group. You approach one or more of Eric, Brenda, and Sherry privately before Tribal Council, let them know what's going to happen, and basically give them an ultimatum, which is, look, somebody in this group is going home. We're letting you in on this information because we trust you. We want you on our side here. You get to pick the boot if you want to, as long as you're willing to come with us. And you can use that as leverage to try and get them to flip over.
Yeah, and Eric's honestly an amazing historical candidate for that, where I feel like he'll happily, if he can get a shot in the final five and try to just bank off those challenges, he'll take it.
Yeah, and I think if you're going to do this, what you say is, this is what we're going to announce at Tribal, that it's going to be one of this person, this person, this person. If this information gets back to them, we're flipping it up and you could be in that rotation instead.
Oh, yeah.
If you really want to play hardball with them.
Right, no, and I think that's a total... listen, I'm not even putting a time... like, given that you have 45 minutes, it's not even about making the best plays. It's about making them make the worst plays, I think. Giving them the most opportunity. And I think Eric is someone you could definitely threaten, which generally isn't a strong tactic, but that would work, I think, a high percentage on someone like Eric.
Well, also, one other way that you could exploit this is to say that, look, we have to play both idols tonight. If you can give us an ironclad commitment that we don't have to, then if we still have an idol, it's yours if you want it. Like, you have that power behind you going forward.
I think, honestly, yeah, first of all, good point. Second of all, with Eric, you may be able to be as direct as, look, hopefully the top of Stealth R Us has made themselves visible. You can present it as, look, you are not in the top of Stealth R Us. You know it. You haven't done anything strategic this whole game. You hope people point to the flag or whatever. We're offering you an opportunity to get to the final four with us. Vote with us now. We'll have idols going ahead. You're there in the final four. And if you win that challenge, you've won the game. Otherwise, we're going to be the final three. I think that's a much better offer than anything else he's going to get, any realistic possibility.
Yeah. Or alternatively, once the three of us are gone, you're going to have to run the table in challenges, and you don't have to do that. If you stick with us, then you're not going to even be on the radar as far as challenge strength goes. Everyone's going to want to kneecap Eddie and Reynolds before they even think about targeting you. You're sitting pretty for the next three or four votes or so.
Also, I mean, with Eric, this is, excuse me, probably thin, but like, hey man, if you flip here, you're like a lock finalist, because no one's going to vote you out after this.
Yeah, that's true. Well, although, yeah.
Except we will at Final Four.
I think that's a bit shaky as an argument. But yeah, I think what that illustrates is there are so many different pitches and lines you can take here that, like, I think this is the option that gives you a ton of freedom to do what you want to do.
Exactly.
And also, if your argument is that you know that no matter what you do this round, next round you're going to have to induce at least one person to flip, put that groundwork in now so it doesn't look opportunistic when you have to do it next week.
Perfect. And because basically the principle is, you are not in Malcolm's position going to win this game by force unless you literally bang off every personal immunity challenge, where you can only have idols for so long, and people are eventually going to be able to hit off at least Reynold or Eddie or probably you the minute you don't have it, which is why I'm such a big advocate for take the line that you feel gives them the most room to mess things up for themselves in the next round. And that's why I'm a huge advocate for showing them before Tribal Council, show them as soon as possible when it's 45 minutes to go. And that's kind of this whole thing, is Eric seems like a wild card who would respond to them messing up. Because if you're Malcolm, you need at some point this round and next round someone to mess up. So maximize the possibility for that. That is the number one goal.
Right. Okay. So another option would be to do basically what Malcolm did, which is have some plan in place going to Tribal Council and then announce right there and then what that plan is. And whether or not, there are a few variants of this, like maybe you bluff what the plan is or not, but what do you think of that idea of timing it so that they can only, like, come up with a plan in this open forum?
I think that's the only real upside to waiting until Tribal Council to do that, is they can't go off into the woods by themselves. Anything they say is going to either be whispered to the person who's sitting next to them, or it's going to be for everyone.
Yeah, I feel like it's a middle-of-the-road option between the option you seem to be advocating, which is most conducive to causing the most chaos possible, and the one which I'm going to argue for in a minute, where you don't even tell them, and you ensure that people's reactions are as sincere as they possibly can be. This seems like you're taking the middle ground without really a reason to do so.
Okay, I guess my whole thing is I'm trying to maximize the time they can screw up and play it by ear from there. I think this may be a good distinction to make, which is if I'm Malcolm at the final nine of Survivor 22 Redemption Island and I'm up against the initial Stealth R Us led by, and it's clear to me that Boston Rob is just telling all of them what to do, in that situation, I am absolutely waiting until Tribal Council to play this, because I know that the way that organization is being run is not a bunch of chickens with their heads cut off. That the reason I'm so big on this and letting them make mistakes is I know these to be players who make mistakes.
Well, I think you raised something interesting there, maybe without even meaning to, which is the correct play here is very dependent upon the structure of the alliance that you're trying to take down. There's this one which doesn't seem to have a clear leader. Obviously, Philip would like to think that he is. But once you remove Philip from the equation, it's like Cochrane, Andrew, and Dawn, they're all like beta personalities. Not, and I don't mean that pejoratively, but I don't think any of them feel the need to be running the show and directing everything. They're happy to just like come to a consensus and do it by ear. Whereas, by contrast, if you're trying to take down an alliance like the original Ometepe, where they're this one dominant figurehead who controls the flow of information, you don't even give him a chance to do anything at all. You use both idols, you take him down, and you try and mix things up after that.
No, totally. And I think more what I meant, even if Boston Rob is immune that round, say he wins the personal immunity challenge, that, I guess Reynolds would have to have it, whatever. Say you can't go for Boston Rob for some reason, I still would wait there because, like you mentioned, it's all about how the opposing alliance works, which is, this is a dictatorship. This guy is going to outright just denounce who everyone that's not this person should be voting for. And then the next round, I can use that and say, look at exactly how all this went down last night. He just said a name and everyone went along with it. How do you think that's going to change if you don't come with us?
Okay. Yeah.
Which is my point about how it's so specific based on the structure of the opposing alliance. And I think this is certainly the type that you want to give room to mess up again.
Sure. So do you think there's any particular merit to this line of announcing it at Tribal Council rather than anywhere else? Or...
Not in this situation. There are in okay. other situations, yeah.
Okay. So the last option, and the one that I think appeals to me most, is just don't announce anything. You let them split the votes in the way that they intended, and now you can... You pretty much have to use both your idols here, and then you have the liberty to split your votes however you like and force them to then cannibalize each other with no room to negotiate, which means their votes that they cast are going to be the most sincere possible expressions of their true feelings.
Oh, I see. So don't tell them at all about the idols before you actually play them and then split your votes. Okay.
The first time they know what's going on is when you give the idols to Jeff.
Right, and they're about to have to re-vote without time to figure anything out. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, see, I definitely can get down with that, although I do kind of like, in that situation, I don't hate, I'm assuming you're splitting it three ways, obviously, so it goes to a revote, which is, I don't hate announcing which three, presumably, three people that you'd like to see come off the board, where it kind of puts the people in a position of, look, if none of you flip here, this is going to a revote, and this, you're gonna have this same situation, but you can flip now, and any of the three people who I've just named can flip and save yourselves, and really make people demonstrate themselves to be reactive.
Well, one of the reasons I don't like that line is that you can't control what's going to happen then, because I think you still have to use both idols, because this is the way you're splitting the votes. So let's say you do one on Andrea, one on Dawn, one on Cochrane, and you announce that. It's perfectly possible that in their desperation, they just not spaz out because they're reacting the way they have to, but they vote in a way which you can't anticipate and ends up with, like, I don't know, three votes on Andrea, Andrea's gone, and then no one's forced to turn on each other anymore. They don't, because, like, as a result of that, they don't have to start telling each other. It's just, it's almost like a weird accident happened and somebody happened to be removed from the game.
Right. It's just kind of like a big Chevrolet power shift at the end of Tribal Council where they're like, oh, our hands are tied. We couldn't do anything. It was a fluke of the moment. And that's why I don't like giving them that out to use with everyone can use it with each other that's left next round. They can, heat of the moment. I don't know. I didn't know what to do. I don't like that.
I guess it does kind of force them to tell each other because they, like, if you're one of the people who's going to receive a vote, then you're presumably going to vote for one of these other people instead now. So it does actually achieve that.
That's what I was thinking about. Specifically, like, if you announce that Cochran's going to be one of the three names going to a revote if no one flips, I'm pretty sure Cochran's going to flip onto Andrea or Dawn to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah. One way to do this, actually, might be to announce these votes as a bluff and then pile your votes on somebody else, because the disadvantage of actually going through with it is that one of these people is going to be removed from the game now, and since they're out of the game, they can't turn on anybody else, and they can't have anyone else turn on them. Whereas, let's say you split it, one on Andrea, one on Dawn, one on Cochrane, and then you pile all of your votes on Philip. Is the best case scenario there is that Philip goes home, and now all of these other people have been forced to vote for each other. They're also in the game now and have to start going at it.
Right, exactly. And I'm wanting people to not have
the excuse of I didn't know what to do. I want people to make deliberate moves that other people know are deliberate, and that again. And I very much like your the idea of or your point about not necessarily wanting to. I'm thinking now about not wanting necessarily to split between the three biggest threats. Although I think it's vastly superior to any other split. Where when you knock one of those three people out that were in the core, it could prompt the people that were on the bottom of Stealth R Us to be like, oh, sweet, I just moved up. Now I'm a final three person in Stealth R Us.
Yeah, and there's also the risk that I outlined earlier, where if you announce publicly that you're going to do this, whether or not you're sincere, the three of them might come to this agreement that, look, we don't want this to be any of us. Let's just agree to put our three votes somewhere, and then you haven't accomplished your goals anymore.
Well, you've at least made them make a deliberate move and vote out one of the people knowingly in their own alliance.
Yeah, but it's not worth wasting two idols to do that.
No, and I agree, and that's why I don't feel like this is a good line. And actually, just going quickly back to something you said about not announcing a target or not announcing anything, I very much agree. And in any line that I took, if I were to announce any kind of target, it would not be until very near the time it's time to vote. It would be much like the same reason I'm showing them the idol back at camp. You guys talk amongst yourselves. You guys create some political fractures, and I'll pick up the pieces from there. But I want to make sure I'm taking this from the right angle, and I need to see how you guys interact to figure out that angle.
I'm trying to think about when. Because I know at Tribal Council there are very specific rules about when you're allowed to talk, like during when the votes are cast and things like that. I'm wondering if you know that you've engineered it so that it's going to be a revote, then given that there's this gap between when Jeff counts the votes and when he reads them, which I've heard different reports, some say it's like 5 minutes, some say it's closer to 20. If as soon as all the votes have been cast, you just announce, okay, this is what we just did, and then you let them stew on it for that like 10 or 15 minutes, without being able to talk to each other, and then...
I'm guessing the minute Jeff says it is time to vote, between then and the time that he says, if anyone has a hidden immunity idol, you want to play it, now's the time, there is no talking.
I'm guessing as well, but if you're allowed to announce that, then they're allowed to talk about it, so it doesn't really change much. So let's say you go with this line, so you don't announce what you're doing beforehand, you use both idols, and you split the votes. The next question obviously becomes, how are you going to split these votes? I think the most natural combination, and the one which all the people I've heard express this idea went for, is you throw one on Andrew, one on Dawn, one on Cochran. You're guaranteed to get one of the power players out that way, and you force everyone in the bottom of the alliance to pick a side. Like, they can't stay on the radar anymore.
Right. The dream scenario there is you have those three names going to a revote, and it comes up with a lot of different names. Because it's not going to just be unanimous, especially if people can't talk before the revote.
Yeah. Like, whichever one person out of those three and Philip you don't pick also has to choose a side, right? So I assume Philip would vote out Dawn there. We don't know how Eric would vote. We don't know how Brent would vote. But we get to find out, and that's the important thing. I think the downside to that line, though, is that, if your idea is to have the top of the pecking order collapse in on itself and try and figure on each other, then given that these are the three people you're voting for, they now can't vote. So you can't make them vote for each other anymore.
Oh, that, I actually hadn't even thought about that, about as it pertains to a revote, that the three you put in there can't vote.
Yeah. I guess the idea would be that if you force Eric, Brendan, and Sherry to pick a side who are the people who are most likely to flip, then they might be more willing to do that now because they've just cast a vote against one of the people who has the ability to punish them for it. So now they might be more scared about staying true to that group.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about making people make deliberate moves, casting a vote for someone is a deliberate move. Like, I want the votes to be cast with knowledge, like people intentionally having weighed their options and decided that this is their best outcome. And in thinking actually further about that Andrea, Don, Cochran thing, having Eric, Brenda, and Sherry be the people re-voting isn't so much the call. So I know we talked a little about this off air. I actually am more liking now the idea of splitting Eric, Brenda, and Sherry.
Okay, so let's discuss that idea now then. The obvious problem with that is that since these are the three people on the bottom, it's less relevant to the people in charge which of them goes, because presumably the idea, at least the one which was floated publicly, was to have the three of them go in some order later anyway. So who cares if Brenda goes now instead of Eric, or if Sherry instead of Brenda? Like, that's not the kind of decision which would make them want to present it. But that's not the kind of decision which forcing them to make would then induce them to resent each other.
Right, and actually, you know, and thinking more about this now, I definitely prefer splitting between Andrea and Don and Cochran just because, yes, you make Andrea and Don and Cochran vote out one of these three people on the bottom, but in doing so, they're also demonstrating that they didn't vote out the other two people whose names were in there and who have survived that round, and also you're having them, the people who have no incentive to flip, vote out one of the people that you're hoping could have flipped for you, and this whole plan is based around having someone flip in these future rounds, which is, I very much actually am back on not liking splitting between Eric and Cher.
All those people who you're trying to flip next week have just been voted for by you when you had the perfect opportunity to take out anyone other than them.
Okay. Right, and like you said, you're doing these people that are in the core of the Alliance a favor in that sense. You're burning both of your idols to take out someone and put the blood on your hands for someone they were all going to have to turn on anyway down the line.
Okay, so I guess the next option would be you do half and half. So you put up maybe one of Andrea, you put up one of Andrea, Cochran, and Dawn, one of Eric, Brendan, and Sherry, and then I guess you make the dynamic that's at work here very clear. So Philip, Cochran, and Dawn are going to vote to keep Andrea. Presumably, Brenda and Sherry are going to vote to keep Eric, though it maybe not, but you at least make it clear that that's the separation here.
Mm-hmm. So I see, actually, in thinking about who, in mixing and matching whatever, I don't think I'm ever putting Sherry down as one of the people for the revote.
Right.
I think that's too easy of an out for them, which means I don't like the idea of mixing and matching, because I think it gives them an easy play.
Yeah, and also, if one of those putative outsiders is deluded about where they actually stand in the group, they could conceivably vote with the people who are actually in charge, and then it's a majority vote against the other outside, at which point you only have one person left who you can try to flip.
Right, only one person who hasn't actually gained by you burning both idols.
Right, so I think that option's off the table as well. The other one would be modifications of ideas that we discussed previously. So let's say instead of piling votes on Philip, you pile votes on Andrea or Cochran or Dawn, but just you keep it exclusively to one of them.
Yeah, I very much like this idea, and it, depending on whether or not announcement or not, I think that's the call, given this scenario.
But given the way, you know, given the hierarchy here, you're not cutting off the head of the snake. You're, you know, like there are four people who could conceivably act as the head of the snake here. So you vote off one, the hydra grows another head, nothing changes, right? So I think the idea of just voting out one person is fundamentally flawed. You have to do something to try and make them vote for each other.
Yeah, you're right. And actually, the more I'm thinking about this now, I feel like, obviously we've approached this entire thing from Malcolm's perspective, and again, it's going to be Malcolm. If this goes through, Malcolm's going to be the one who ends up winning. So who is your choice boot here if you're Malcolm in the dark?
It's not Cochran, and here's why. Let's say you get one person to float next round, and it's 4v4. We already know that Cochran is liable to not want to draw rocks in tied vote. So if he's on the other side, it's possible that he gets through it again. And if it goes to a tie, he flips over, and all of a sudden you're up 5-3 in your garden.
I feel like I would have faith in John Cochran to draw rocks there instead of flipping down to be on the bottom of it. Yeah, I do.
Well, we talk about players learning lessons from their previous seasons, and I'm not quite sure what lesson Cochran would learn. Do you think he sees his error in Tata Civic as not wanting to draw rocks, or in not getting on with his group, or maybe not doing things correct once he got to a podium, or it's unclear to me that having failed at this once means that he's just not going to do it ever again.
Okay, I guess who knows how he would react to this, and I really kind of want to see this play out now, where he's forced to go to rocks correctly or chooses whether or not to. I think Cochran may be the type who assigns his not doing well last season. Obviously, it was 100% just his initial tribe draw, I think, and then, so obviously, the total lack of experience and lack of being able to get along with those kinds of people. But I think he could overcompensate one of two ways, one of which is obviously good for you, which is he's always going to flip back, and that's what you want. I think his second time around now, especially when he's in such a solid position, he might interpret himself, my lesson was I didn't go to rocks when I should have. And if I had gone to rocks, when we talked to him, we talked about the very real pot. Everyone we talked to said it was very real that Cochran could have won if he'd gone to rocks and Savai had taken the numbers.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
So I wouldn't necessarily be banking on a plan to flip Cochran, just given how I know he's evolved as kind of like a player since seeing his first season.
So going back to this general principle here of trying to make people scared, we've seen that Cochran can get scared, although maybe he's learned from that. We've also seen throughout this season that Andrea is prone to get very frantic when she perceives that she's in danger. So I think you don't want to vote out her here because you want her to be getting more and more paranoid. Obviously, she can't do that if she's at Ponderosa.
Oh, yeah. And that's why, along similar lines, is given just the reason Cochran popped into my mind as a potential boot and perhaps Malcolm's best boot is everyone's cool with Cochran, and it seems like Cochran within Stealth R Us is the level-headed one, the peacemaker, kind of keeping people calm, which is crazy.
So weird to say, yeah.
But realistic, I think. And if your goal is to cause chaos in the following rounds, I think this could be a lot like, for instance, why Dan would target Brittany during Dan's funeral, which is no one's coming after Brittany. Like, how is anyone going to make this happen? And she's kind of she's running this kind of cohesive unit. And when you get to pick who goes, and it seems like Cochran's never otherwise going to go, and as much as Philip is the figurehead, I think Cochran is realistically the glue kind of holding Stealth R Us together and keeping them relatively sane. I see a lot of merit in leaving a fractured alliance, and surprised at alliance of Philip, Andrea, Dawn, Brenda, Eric, Sherry. Like, I could see a lot going wrong within that group.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually, because I was going to say that Dawn might be the stable one, and obviously she's had her meltdowns, but they haven't been game-related meltdowns. These are personal struggles that she's going through. They're not game-related ones. But now that you mentioned that, like, Dawn isn't really tied that strongly to Philip, and without Cochran there to act as this calming influence on her, I can see her just going off the rails.
Oh, right. I mean, any surprise boot that Dawn doesn't like, she's going to fly off the handle, right?
The issue, yeah. She herself isn't going to be disloyal because that's just not a part of who she is, but she can, through her actions, inspire other people to be disloyal.
Right, right, exactly. And that's what we're looking for. That's the name of the game here for Malcolm.
Yeah. So now that we mentioned that, I think actually the best play is a variant of one we suggested earlier, which is you don't reveal anything until Tribal Council. You know that you're going to idol yourself, you being Malcolm, and Eddie. You cast your vote for Eddie, right, and you have your two other guys split their votes, one on Andrea, one on Cochran, because these two seem to be, firstly, the linchpins working together, but also they are like the locus for the other people in their alliance. So Andrea's the one keeping Philip in, Cochran's the one keeping Dawn in. Now you force everyone in that alliance to take a side between one of those two. You know that those two people are the ones most likely to get paranoid if votes are getting cast against them. So you have, I think this is the way that you're most likely to cause some kind of fracture in there.
This is brilliant. I mean, because a big problem that you face when you're splitting is that three votes can't split between two people evenly. So if you burn your vote, you're exactly right. I think that's brilliant. Yeah. That's legit. I can't even believe that's fantastic stuff.
See, the thing is, if you agree that Andrew and Cochran are the two people actually controlling things, despite whatever, like, possible personality flaws or whatever, then if you throw a third person in there, it's possible that third person just gets instantly nixed.
Exactly.
Whereas now, not only because they're on the outside of that alliance, but also because the other people on the outside don't want to upset the powers that be, and they know they can just vote out this third person. Now everyone has to vote out somebody who's perceived as important.
I feel like my eyes are wide open. The other, and that's probably among the best plans I've heard. The other thing I was thinking about is, along those same lines, is Andrea is not someone who's going to handle things necessarily well if things don't go as she had planned, which is what we've seen. I think if I'm going to announce anyone, I honestly feel, as my target, I feel like I might be announcing Andrea close to 100% of the time and never actually putting our votes on her, whether we're splitting or whatever, but trying to get other people, make it clear that we weren't actually voting for her, but get other people to put votes on her. Because I think she's going to be the one to try to overcompensate the most the next round.
The problem with that, though, is the same thing we saw. It's the same problem with announcing they're going to vote out Philip, which is they can rely on your votes being enough to vote out Philip, or in this case, Andrea. So they can afford to sit to the plan in the knowledge that they're safe and that your votes are enough to send that person home. Like, again, if you're Brenda here, you want Andrea gone, but you know that you don't have to cast a vote for Brenda to do that if they're going to follow through and vote for Andrea.
Okay, see, this is obviously where a ton of the complexity in the situation lies, but I feel like if you're announcing someone, I feel like there's overwhelming value in announcing Andrea, even maybe more so than Philip, to count on her not handling it the most calmly. Like her I think overcompensating is the perfect word. You want someone who's going to try to overcorrect and try to change her position if anything goes awry. And I'm trying to get someone to put a stray vote on Andrea. Like, I think Eric probably still then votes for Andrea last time, and things are different if they announce Andrea and vote Philip.
Okay, so anyway, back to what you were saying about my plan being fucking brilliant.
Right. I'm trying to think of, well, now I haven't even considered, God damn, that's smart. That's why, oh my God.
Yeah, like, the issue
I feel like that's effectively voting Andrea out, though.
No, see, here's the thing. This is what you do. You split it 1-1 on the initial vote, then on the revote, you pile your votes onto Cochran in an attempt to ensure that he goes, because I imagine Philip would vote out Cochran, right, over Andrea, and then your 3 votes would be enough to get Cochran out of there. Now, Andrea suddenly has 3 votes on her. She's still there. You've lost Cochran, who's the linchpin of everything, and now Andrea's just spazzing all around the island trying to get a grip on herself, and, you know, Philip's a wreck, Dawn's a wreck, and suddenly, these 3 on the bottom don't know what's happening anymore.
If I knew that I could announce between the vote and the revote, I don't know what the rules are about discussion there. If you could make it clear that, hey, all 3 of our votes on this revote are going on Cochran, you would be wise to do the same. And then you still get a couple people probably voting for Andrea.
No. Because if you do that, then they just vote for Cochran. It's a problem. So, if anything, what you want to say is, we're all voting for Andrea. You power vote on her, you actually vote out Cochran, because you know that Philip is so obstinate that he's just not going to vote out Andrea. Right? I think you can bank on that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm counting on Philip being a non-Andrea vote if she's one of the 2, so.
So, hold on, let's...
How do you get votes on Andrea? That's what I'm trying to do without her going. I think that is the goal. Like, I think we've arrived that that is the goal. Get Andrea...
Hold on. Okay, so how many people... This happened with 10 left, right?
Yeah.
So if it's between Cochran and Andrea, and you put your 3 votes on Cochran, Philip puts his vote on Cochran, then everyone else puts their votes on Andrea. It's a 4-4 tie again, so everyone draws rocks.
No. Oh, shit, yeah. 8 people are rocks. Yeah, oh my God.
Wait, so would people who played an idol...
But you've played idols. Yeah, oh, yeah.
Would they be immune?
Of course.
So that would be perfect, then.
That'd be fucking amazing.
So that's perfect, then, because now all of the 3 amigos are immune. Cochran and Andrew are immune by virtue of the fact that they've been voted for, which is, I think, what you want, actually, because if you're causing this much chaos, which is guaranteed to happen if you're going to rocks, then I think you want the 2 people most likely to flip out about it still in the game, especially since, you know, everyone else is going to have had to pick a side. Like, Philip's going to have to have voted for Cochran. Everyone else is going to have to have voted for Andrea. So now you can try and play those 2 against each other. And so you go to rocks. Somebody else gets removed from the game. It could be Dawn, could be Sherry, could be Eric, could be Brenda, could be Philip. In a sense, it doesn't really matter who it is, because now everything's been shaken up so dramatically. Like, if our guiding principle here is that when the status quo is bad for you, you need to cause chaos. This is about as much chaos as you can cause in a game of Survivor. Like, causing everyone to go to rocks. It'd be fucking great for TV as well, just incidentally. This might actually be a smart thing to do. Now, if this doesn't work out, and maybe Philip doesn't vote the way you want, or there are so many votes piling on Cochran or whatever, then you still got one of the biggest threats out of the game. You've still accomplished everything we set out to accomplish. So, like, worst case is the best case in every other case, right? And the best case is you just break the whole game wide open.
Oh, totally. And I think, so are you saying... Okay, I guess perfect world here is the play. Everyone votes the first time. You only have 2 live votes to revote onto Cochran and Andrea. I think that the call would be announce that you're going to put your votes on Andrea to try to get more people to put their votes on Andrea, knowing that Philip's going to be on Cochran. You 3 are going to be on Cochran. Worst case is rocks, and best case is Cochran or not even necessarily best case, but another fine instance is Cochran goes and Andrea's got some votes on her from other people.
That's true. My worry about that, though, is that then they can use as an excuse the fact that you said that you were going to vote for Andrew, right? They can say, look, we feel that there was a majority on you anyway. We didn't want to mix things up. But this way, they're forced to actually choose between Andrew and Cochran, and whatever that choice is, it's a reflection of how they're thinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess actually, if you do go to Rocks, then this is even more perfect, where if the revote comes back on Rocks, where Andrea and Cochran, as you said, are both still there, and all this chaos has happened, and four people have voted against Andrea, and four people have voted against Cochran. Although I'm concerned about that might perhaps draw, I don't think that's necessarily going to splinter up Cochran and Andrea, which is a pair I'm maybe more so than any other, concerned about, or a duo at least, not a tight-knit pair. But yeah, there's honestly with this plan, there's like really no disaster scenario, and a lot of things can go really well.
I guess the worst case would be that you pull this off, and then anyone whose mind is a flip thinks these guys are just they're fucking lunatics. We can't there's no way we can team up with these people anymore. Which it seemed like they were thinking that anyway, but you know.
Right. The problem is it doesn't buy you any kind of like long term. Okay, now we're in a voting block loyalty. But it does again. As I don't know how many times I'm saying it, the goal is to make something happen for yourself that so that it carries over into the next round. And I think this is brilliant in doing so.
Yeah. So whatever the merits of this, and I think it is a good plan. Like I just came up with this now, and it's what a week later, and then like a week later after having been able to digest the episode, and after an hour of conscious thought about it. I can quite understand why Malcolm, like, with 45 minutes to think about this, in high-pressure conditions, in this atmosphere of paranoia, not only wouldn't be able to think of this, I can understand why any of these other plans that people have been throwing around, like, splitting the votes or whatever, I can understand why that wouldn't, like, occur to him and why he wouldn't be able to make that happen. So, you know, as much as we like to say Malcolm made the wrong move, I'm still going to defend him here because, you know, he was in an impossible situation, I think. He did what seemed to him to be the best he could do at the time, and, you know, it didn't work out, but that's the way it goes.
Right. It's kind of like once Corinne was gone, Malcolm was going to have a really hard time winning this game, and I think he took active measures into his own hands to really give himself a chance to do that. And obviously we know now that it didn't end up working out, but this is a really impressive stuff, and I don't fault him because, again, he didn't have that much time to think through it, and he gave himself an easy line, basically.
So, yeah, let's put it this way. We're more than willing to criticize Malcolm for the mistakes that we think he made this season, just based on what we're being shown. But I think those mistakes came long before this. Like, at this point, we're debating what the epilogue to the story should be after it's already been written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
So, going back to the first week, deciding not to side with Francesca, and then, you know, at the merge, potentially maybe mismanaging the way that vote went down. Yeah, I think those are the two decisions you can look at and legitimately criticize him for this. Yeah, okay, maybe the execution wasn't perfect, but neither was the plan. The plan couldn't have been.
Right, exactly. Because of the decisions he'd made previously, there was just nothing realistically he could do besides bang off immunities every time.
Yeah, and I hope we get the chance to talk to Malcolm about this in person someday and really get a sense of what's going through his head at this point. Because, you know, you can kind of infer that from his written interviews, but those are like 15-minute short rapid-fire questions. It'd be nice to discuss that with him in detail. Hopefully we'll get the chance to someday.
Oh, definitely. And I think it's also very much worth noting, like we did before, 45 minutes is not a lot of time to come up with a plan, and certainly not one that you can be confident in, especially knowing how high the stakes are and how much pressure is going to be on you to execute this.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've discussed that for, I say far too long, but I enjoyed every minute of it.
Yeah.
It's time to move on, I think. So, yeah, that kind of closes the book on episode 10. You know, we like to give our final thoughts on the person who got booted. Final thoughts on Philip, I guess, because he's been like an integral part of the season so far.
Yeah, I had a couple of thoughts about Philip and, you know, his boot. I didn't love him getting cast in the first place. I wasn't loving him while he was on the show. I think the way he went out, first of all, I was shocked. Secondly, not only shocked that he was the boot, but shocked at how he handled himself, because it seemed like he really was, like you said earlier, just kind of taking a bullet for Stealth R Us and going down on a sinking ship. And maybe it's, again, that fascination he has with this is the only way I'm going to play Survivor. I'm going to make Stealth R Us the story. But, you know, for whatever reason, I was actually pretty impressed with Philip and the way he handled it. I don't necessarily think it was strategically sound to tell people, keep voting the way you're voting and I'll take one. I obviously don't play your way out of the game. But at the same time, I was surprised and impressed by Philip when it's all said and done with not so much his play, but his exit, I guess, which is I'll praise Philip for that, I guess.
Yeah, I wasn't a fan of having Philip back in the first place. I certainly wasn't a fan of the way he was like a black hole of airtime this season. But, you know, now that he's gone, like, I think he handled his exit interviews and stuff with good graces, which is more than you can say for some people. I'm very glad he's gone. I'm sad that he wasn't gone earlier, but now it's time to move on. Hopefully the season can pick up from here, and it you know, we're moving into the home stretch of the season now where there's not really time for some of these underedited characters to make a name for themselves, but what little they can do, hopefully we get to see that.
Mm-hmm. Are you excited for Stealth RS 3.0?
I feel like that's pretty much a lock at this point, right? It has to be.
Yeah. Okay.
I think that gets ended pretty quickly, I have to say.
I mean, so far so good on people trying to drag Philip. It's pretty weird circumstances that he went out. It seems like a pretty fundamentally sound game plan.
Well, when Philip isn't on the try stacked with people who are naturally disposed to align with him, then I think he'll have a far harder task.
Oh, I mean, I feel like Philip had historically one of the toughest starting tribe draws of all time. I feel like that's what we were talking about before we actually saw this play out, is that he was screwed. It took Francesca kind of playing her way out. But that's fair.
I think it might be fair to say that, you know, any tribe draw is pretty much going to be bad for Philip, but this one, like, given the presence of Francesca there, it created this high-risk, high-reward scenario where, you know, one of them is going to be a central part of whichever alliance ended up emerging dominant. We were convinced it was going to be Francesca, and justifiably so, I think, but it ended up being Philip, and, you know, after that point, it was predictable that he would get this far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure we'll see Philip again if Survivor runs another even two seasons or four seasons.
Yeah, and I agree that had this not happened, had this incredibly improbable set of events not played out, that he would be sitting down in the final three again.
Right.
At the same way that I think the Brittany comparison is excellent. Had Brittany not been evicted at the point that she was, then I don't think there's any way she doesn't go all the way to the end.
Well, it's tough in Big Brother, but I mean, to me, Philip is like a much less likable version of Sandro. Like, once he gets himself into once he gets himself into a position, he's gonna be there in the end. Granted, it's for the, not the reasons that he's gonna go on to win, which, to Sandra's credit, she has gone on to win, but it's basically automatic.
Yeah, okay. I can see that. So, that does it for episode 10, I think. So we get to move on to finally the episode which people have actually watched this week, which is episode 11.
Yeah, welcome everyone who just fast-forwarded to this point. So we just lost Chef. We spent a great deal of time talking about that. And this episode, there was actually, I'm sure you, alarm bells were going off for you. There was a ton of Brenda early on, which I'm thinking means ball game over next week, which is a lot why I'm thinking one of the bros is going to survive this double eviction.
Well, I was convinced, when I saw that, I was convinced it was going to be game over this week, which I was despondent. I was getting ready for you to, like, launch mocking gifts at me on Twitter. I was preparing the pity party, but thankfully she managed to survive. Although, as you said, I think she could easily be a casualty of a double eviction.
Right, well, and they seem fond of the introduce a person now, the episode before they get voted out, because after 13 years, people caught on when someone just started showing up, and they would always go at the end of that episode.
It's a new radical strategy. So,
yeah.
All right, so we go back to camp now, and we see the standard post-tribal council denouement, and usually this is a fairly mundane affair, but obviously after what happened with Phillips, it was going to be anything but. And I think the most significant thing here was we get this confessional from Eric again. Like, this was ringing alarm bells in my head because Eric's someone we typically don't see anything of either. We see Eric saying that now that Philip's gone, he feels like he can talk to people and not have to be, like, looking over his shoulder the whole time, which, to me, it made me wonder if Philip's hold was maybe stronger than we were seeing and Malcolm was more attuned to this than we could be as viewers.
I think that's maybe not likely, but it's certainly a possibility. And we saw Philip really turn Eric off, even on day one, trying to approach him to be in the alliance. And maybe Eric just couldn't let bygones be bygones the entire time. I don't know.
Yeah, like, maybe this wasn't Eric turning against Arthur Ross, it was Eric seizing a chance to vote against Philip, and, you know, now that he was able to get that grudge out of the way, it's back to business as usual.
Maybe that's more incentive than the craziness at Tribal Council that we just went through, that Eric said, hey, finally a chance to get rid of Philip here, hence flipping back on the Philip vote. All right, so up next we get the tree mail. It is auction time, everyone's favorite Survivor auction, and I think that the key factor in this is something we looked ahead a bit about, I guess just talking off air, but Malcolm is going to have a situation now where he's going to either have potentially both of a hidden immunity idol clue as well as a challenge advantage. So he, you know, we hear from him beforehand, like, granted it's the auction, but I know I may not be able to eat because I gotta save my money for this, because if I use up any of my money, someone could just max bid and I can't get these items. And of course, first item Jeff pulls out, first 20 gets beer and nuts. Boom, 20. Take it. And it's like, oh! So now Malcolm's max bid is at 480 and he could have just fucked himself out of the game potentially if, granted it ends up paying off, but yeah.
Yeah, a story checking out more than any other story has ever checked out, I believe.
Yeah, oh, we were on the Malcolm is an alcoholic train very early in Survivor Philippines, and I had no idea how heavily this one was going to come in, but I'm very proud of that call.
Yeah, I mean, we get pretty much everything else wrong, but it's the big things that we really get right.
Oh, that's been like, I mean, apart from the Golden Boy, that's like his most notable characteristic is his always wanting a drink, basically.
Right.
Yeah, I've been there.
Well, one interesting thing for Malcolm, actually, like, you said he has to suspect that there's going to be at least one of a challenge advantage and an idol clue. Let's say a challenge advantage comes up for auction. Do you immediately bid on that, or do you try and wait for the idol clue?
You don't even know
that there's going to be an idol clue there. Like, you see that they've rehidden it once before, but you may think, well, that's the last of it. It's not going to be in the game anymore.
Right. I bid if whichever one pops up first, I'm all in on, because I don't know if another one's coming.
Yeah. And you instantly 500?
Oh, yeah. Don't even get it. Why leave the door open for someone else to come back and say 500?
It's weird, though, because even the people who, there are some items that weren't aired, and maybe nobody had 500 left at this point, but it's weird that even people like Cochran, who have seen this before, Andrew, like people who know that this stuff is happening, they still firstly blow their load too early and don't wait for these items to come up. And then when they do, they don't outbid the people who actually need them.
Right. I mean, a big factor of that is these people had, we saw it in secret scenes more than on the actual show. They were like out of food, and these people were all starving. And we saw like Eric in a secret scene talk about how when Andrea had the decision to trade the rice and beans, he said he would have taken the spaghetti. Like, I think that's how hungry they were.
Yeah.
And they all, I think, honestly, it's a lot of they all knew not many of them were going anywhere.
If you've been watching the show all this time and you've seen that every single auction people just get away with buying items they really have no right to be getting, at what point do you say, I'm not going to bid 500 for this item because I know that I can get it for less. I'm just going to try and get myself a plate of food or something in addition.
That's a good question. And this is, you know, I've long advocated for the Mick Trimming Snap 500. If you feel safe and see a delicious item that's uncovered and you know you're just going to get it and then you're out of the auction and it's good and you got your steak. I feel like people have adjusted now and so many people are doing that. We saw Denise and Scoopin do it last time, I think. And this time we saw Dawn and Sherry both just snap whole roll everything. And the point of the Mick Trimming is not put all your money out there as quickly as possible. It's adjust to the way everyone else is playing. And since for the first however many seasons, it was always min raise, min raise, min raise. And then finally, the revolutionary genius Mick comes along and slams 500. But now everyone's just slamming 500. So go with the min raise. I've said before, these auctions have become totally buyer's markets.
How much is Mick paying you to get his name out there?
Not enough.
What do you make of them not being able to share money? Because in the past, I can understand the reasoning for not letting them do that because potentially I could hoard like 500 or something and my closest ally could save 200, get himself something to eat. And then I know that if an item comes up, we can just put our combined 700, get it, and they can't do anything about it. But at the same time, it's always been fun in the past to see people like negotiate for parts of items and share money. And, you know, I think at the Cook Islands auction especially, it's like you'll hand your stuff over to Becky to bid on more money, which they then use Exile Candace. Like, there's a lot of kind of fun stuff going on. So, I mean, what do you make of it?
It's by far more interesting politically. I don't like it at all when they can share money. I'm fine if they can. I don't care if they share food, but as long as just one person bought it, because of what we know about every auction now is going to have that challenge advantage designed for the person who's desperate to get it, and they're just never going to be able to get it.
Yeah, I feel like the point of having that advantage off of grabs is that someone who's on the bottom can get it if they need to, and being able to share money just completely eliminates the possibility of that. Although, weirder things have happened before.
Oh, yeah. You're right. It's certainly more, no question, more interesting strategically and, like, opens up the social game. But I feel like it's only going to reward the people that are already in a good position, whereas I feel like you should be trying to reward the people or give them outs in the bad position to at least make it interesting. Yeah. All right. So if we want to roll through, actually, Reynolds, I think, had an interesting item or an interesting situation where – and I think it's very worth noting how much he spent on this, which is $180. So he has $320 left behind. He gets a covered item, and Jeff gives him an offer to trade it between one of two other covered items. And Cochran says, oh, it's the Monty Hall problem. You should just switch. What are you thinking about this? Because obviously it's come up. This is not specifically the Monty Hall problem.
But my immediate thought is I'm not rooting for Cochran anymore. I need to find something new to root for. Preferably someone who understands basic statistics, who isn't crying all the time, so that rules out Brenda. Like, just someone who isn't going to randomly name drop mathematical concepts and get it wrong in the process. But for people who are unfamiliar with the Monty Hall problem, basically it's from a game show that was on a while back. I can't remember the name. But the basic idea is you're presented with three doors. You And behind one of them's a car, behind the other two a goat. And the host, the presenter who's administering this, knows where all the items are. So you get to pick one of the doors. You don't know, you don't have any indication as to what's behind them. And then once you pick your door, the host opens one of the other doors to reveal a goat and asks you if you want to switch or not. And so the basic idea is, when you originally chose your item, you had a 1-in-3 chance of picking the car. But now that you know, after the host reveals this and offers you the switch, it's always correct to switch, because now it's a 1-in-2 chance that if you switch, you're going to get the car versus a 1-in-3 chance you had originally. And I don't want to go through the whole, like, the reasoning now. It's fairly counterintuitive, which is why it's become such a famous problem. But basically, it's a kind of thing which, like, you hear about it, and even if you're not the most mathematically inclined person, you can kind of understand it after it's explained to you. Now, Cochran just randomly name-dropping this, I think it sums up everything that people dislike about him, more so than this whole I'm a challenge beast, results-oriented crap or whatever. And I'm not sure how much of that he actually believes, but anyway. Because there are some obvious differences between the two cases, right? So, in the Monty Hall problem, firstly, you get to pick what your starting item. Here, Jeff Probst gives you the starting item and lets you, and then offers you the choice afterwards, which means you then have to consider the psychology of, well, what would Jeff offer me first, and where would he place the other items, and so on. In the actual Monty Hall problem, none of that's the case. Secondly, Reynolds doesn't know how the items are distributed, so he doesn't know whether there are two good items, one bad item, or, you know, if they're on a spectrum, like, is this an average item, and a really good item, and a really bad item, or whatever. And thirdly, after he's made his choice, Jeff doesn't reveal any of the other items to show you what it was. So that whole element of the probability switching, which is what makes the Monty Hall problem, isn't present there. So the two cases are just completely non-comparable, and yet Cochran decided to show his intelligence by referencing it anyway. Now, maybe he was just trolling Reynolds, and if so, he successfully trolled me and everyone else, and you know, I applaud him, but I don't know. This tilted me more than anything else this episode.
I disagree. I disagree, because this is, and you're right, that there's no, if all the items are going to be randomized, which one you buy first and which two you get swapped, then you're just swapping from one unseen item to another unseen item. It's completely neutral EV. However, when we do factor in which one Jeff's going to give you first and what the likely three items are, I think there's going to be one total dummy prize, which was the coconut, one okay thing, and one just total jackpot. And I also don't think the jackpot is ever going to be the initial item, which means I think if you want to go for the jackpot, and given that it's, if you switch, you have a 1-in-2 shot at it versus if you stay and you have a no shot at it, especially when you've only bid 180 out of your 320, out of your 500, you've got 320 left in a buyer's market, basically. I'm going for that mother load, and basically the math I'm doing here, this is not the Monty Hall problem. You're right. I think this is the Jeff Probst problem, which is, as long as I feel that the jackpot prize is going to be at least twice as good or more than the okay prize, always switch. Because I think that they're not going to just hand you one and let you stand pat and get the jackpot. You're going to have to switch and guess right, I think, to get the jackpot. And it's so worth switching and gambling on it, because you're going to get an entire pizza versus one slice.
Yeah. I'm always tempted to say that he's almost always going to offer you the middle of the road item with the other two being right there, because, like, think about what would happen if you either declined the switch or if the items were arranged differently. So, in this case, let's say the original item was the rotten coconut and the other two things were the pizza and the rest of the pizza. The other two items were the pizza slice and the rest of the pizza. It'd be kind of weird for him to say, look, you could have won a pizza slice or the rest of the pizza. Like, right. That's a kind of weird way to go about it. And similarly, you wouldn't start with the rest of the pizza and then reveal that and say, well, you could have run this slice of pizza, which is worse than your item, or this rotten coconut. Like, it feels like you can always have the safe choice, or you can take a gamble. And, like, given that you have one slice out of a, what, 8-10 slice pizza, like, it seems like a pretty easy gamble to take.
Right, exactly. And the point is, no, it is not specifically the same fundamentals as the Monty Hall problem, but it's the same idea, which is you should always switch, because if you're better off, there's more out there in the two than there's ever going to be in the one, by at least twice as much every single time. Granted, one of them is going to be a dummy. And at the same time, they're just, like you said, they're not going to give you the mother load and let you stay on that and then show you the two bad ones. Like, it's always going to be good, bad, I think. Like, best and bad are going to be the two, and then okay is going to be the initial one. And so I think a pizza is like a perfect way to look at this, which is you can guarantee yourself one slice, which your equity, if you just stay there, is one, or there are seven remaining slices, and you have a one in two shot at those seven, so your equity is 3.5 slices, if you just think about it like that. And I think one slice of pizza versus the whole pizza is almost a perfect ratio for how the medium item versus jackpot item is going to go. So again, much like the Monty Hall problem, you should always switch.
So we've now thought about it more than anybody else had or even wanted to. So
one more thing on that, actually, which is, I you know, people very, very eager to slam Cochran for this. I would say, given Reynolds' reaction, which is, oh, I don't try to, fuck you, Cochran, like, you're just trying to get me to screw with this. And I know it was mostly joking, but it was still clearly dismissive. He was not going to listen to Cochran. I think had this been the Monty Hall problem, if Jeff pulls the thing off the coconut, Reynolds and Cochran could honestly say, oh, always switch now. Reynolds would still stick with his initial item. Reynolds is such a guy who would stick with his initial item. He is the definition of that guy. Yeah. People, it's crazy.
I think for him, it's like a symbol of confidence. Like, yeah, I chose this item and I'm going to sit with it. Like, you didn't choose it. You were presented with it originally. It was, it wasn't at random, but it wasn't your choice. Like, you have no emotional investment in whatever this is at all. So why do you care?
Right, exactly. And furthermore, not only just Reynolds, that is such a massive part of the human condition, I think, that the show that Monty Hall was the host of, that this is all derivative, is called Let's Make a Deal, which is a very fitting name for Survivor. This show debuted late 60s, early 70s, I would guess. It is still on today, and they are bleeding equity with the prizes that they give away, but so few people are willing to switch. They want the one that, hey, oh, I picked this one. This one's mine, and that's such a human impulse, and like you said, that's why it's counterintuitive. That's what counterintuitive means. Yeah. All right. So next item up for bids is information within the game, and Malcolm instantly puts in his whole entire 480, and no one, I don't know who had what amount of money left, but no one went to 500. So he gets this, and he gets 60 seconds to look at an idle clue, which is basically a map of to the idle. And I know we want to push most of this Malcolm's new potential idle off for the time being, but I was interested. I'd be curious to know who didn't raise him to 500, and like, I feel like Brenda would be fine to not raise him to 500, but some people wouldn't if they're, like, the ones who could be screwed by it.
See, this is weird, because I feel like this is the kind of thing where you can say, if you haven't done much in the game, so if I need to build your resume, this is the perfect kind of thing to do it, because it doesn't require any kind of skill on your part. It's just you bid your money and you're done. But it's the kind of thing which you can say, like, if you're in front of a jury, what moves did you make in the game? Well, at the time when it was necessary, I was willing to sacrifice 500. I bided my time. I built the item. I stopped the person who needed it from getting it, and I did that on behalf of my entire group. Like, that's it's not a great argument, maybe, but it's an argument you can make.
Right, and this is actually, I mean, it's the nature of hidden immunity items themselves in general, which is, it's not even necessarily that someone who should race to 500 because they necessarily themselves need it. It's they need to keep it out of the wrong hands, and Malcolm is decidedly the wrong hands here, I think. So next, Andrea spends $280 and gets a big plate of spaghetti and meatballs, but unfortunately she is the one who is offered the trade for her prize for rice and beans for the tribe. Obviously this is not a consideration whatsoever, unless, you know, Eric had this secret scene about not wanting to do it, and I guess if you're Cindy Hall, Dom's beloved Cindy Hall, you don't want to give everyone else a car.
I love Cindy Hall now?
I think so. Do you not?
Well, that's news, but I'll take it.
Okay.
I like this attitude where, Andrew walks up to the thing, and Jeff says, "You have a dilemma." There's kind of a grin on his face, and Andrew's like, "Oh, fuck." Maybe not in those words, but yeah.
Jeff must love the sight of people freaking out in Survivor. It must be, I'm sure, like nothing short of human blood at this point can satiate his thirst for power and whatever. But I'm sure it's music to his eyes, I guess, to mix metaphors there. Every single time he sees someone's like about to panic, because I'm sure he's had so many just boring things happen, or Survivor's pretty boring. Granted, we've spent, I don't know, 2 hours at least so far talking about two episodes.
I mean, 2 hours of an edited show, like 7 or 8 hour time commitment by this point, I think.
Yeah. All right. So obviously Andrea's going to trade that. They get rice and beans for the rest of the time. Standard play by Andrea. So this is a very interesting one next, I think, which is the advantage in the next immunity challenge. That's right. There is not only an IO clue, there is the advantage. And the bidding stayed low here, which was mind-blowing. And I know Reynolds wasn't big on money, but Eddie wouldn't go above, like, 300. And then Cochran
smartly took it out of his hands and said, I'll put up 340 to keep it out of Eddie's hands, and that was good enough, and Cochran got the advantage. And the big deal about this is, I mean, if history is any indication, this is not just an advantage. This is basically the immunity necklace. So this is obviously a very sick play for Cochran, even though he didn't necessarily need to be the one to do it. This is, again, I think just a total no-brainer and really impressed me. I think not everyone would do that.
Yeah, I don't know. It turns out the advantage is far bigger than I think even Cochran could have hoped it would be, because it turns out that it's the same challenge we saw in Samoa, actually, after the auction there, where everyone's holding a fixed percentage of their body weight away from them using a rope, and every so often, after intervals of 5 minutes, you have to move down the rope, making it harder and harder to hold onto it, until eventually you're just hanging onto the rope. Now, Cochran's advantage was he gets to, at any point he wishes, and obviously can only use it once, he gets to move up 2 knots. But the thing is, after they've reached the final stage where everyone else was holding on, Cochran got to stay like that permanently. He didn't have to move down again after 5 minutes.
I was thinking about that. That's crazy.
Yeah, so his hand was supported by a knot for the whole way through, which means you put anyone else in this spot, I mean, literally anybody else, then they're probably the runaway, then they're the runaway favorite at that point to win the challenge.
Oh, but I mean, honestly, ever since Guatemala, where Danny got the challenge advantage, and it was the giant puzzle, and her advantage was you can switch places with anyone at any time, which is basically once someone has secured enough squares, you can take their place and lock yourself immunity, basically free immunity for buying it. There's nothing off the table, I think. Like, if I'm Cochran, I'm almost fully expecting this to equal immunity.
Yeah, I mean, there's no point having this be up for grabs in the first place if you don't want the people who need it most to be able to get it and to be able to use it to their advantage, right? Because, like, let's say this was a challenge that Reynolds, for instance, or Malcolm or whoever just wasn't really disposed to win, like some complicated puzzle or whatever it may be. Giving them a slight advantage in that isn't really going to change anything. Whereas this is a challenge which is always going to be competitive, and you know for sure that giving someone this type of advantage is going to really reap dividends for them.
Right, exactly. This is a brilliant design by the people crafting the game structure, which is you're putting in an item that is naturally going to be the highest priority for the people that are on the bottom and the people who most need immunity to shake things up. And thus, you want that person to be getting immunity to make TV. Like, this is not a coincidence that it's always someone who needs it generally that gets it.
Sure, but you want it to at least still be competitive, right? You don't want this to be a guaranteed win for whoever buys it, because, like, Danny's advantage of Guatemala, where she gets to switch places with someone on that puzzle, that you have to be pretty stupid not to win when you have that going for you.
Well, I would say this one, you have to be pretty weak not to win when
you have this one. Exactly. You know, I think this was another example of bad design in that sense then, because, or maybe not bad design, but I think during the challenge, he should still have been moved, forced to move down at 5 minute intervals.
Oh, I definitely agree with that. Like, you know, Eddie's hanging out there, not moving down, but for the last 10 minutes, definitely. The thing is, I like that it's almost a guaranteed win, and I like that thinking players who have experience, who know the game, know that. I think it adds a big twist, and it totally changes the dynamics of the auction, because otherwise it's just who can time the getting their food the best. Like, I don't think the auctions with no dummy prizes are fun, and I certainly don't think the auctions pre-advantage were necessarily – they're fun to, like, see people happy, but it's not fun for the game.
See, if there's going to be some kind of in-game advantage being sold at the auction, I'd much prefer it to be what Malcolm ends up getting, which we can get onto now if you want, which is occlusion and idle, where firstly it's going to possibly lead to a more long-lasting shake-up, because, you know, if somebody wins immunity one round, if they're still in the hot seat, they're probably just going next week anyway. So maybe it keeps it around for one more episode, but it's only a temporary thing. Whereas if they manage to fight an idol, and keep in mind, I wouldn't want it to be one of these things where you just put your hand in a tree and, oh, hey, Gresso, there's an idol there. You want it to be like the one that Malcolm couldn't find, where it's buried deep underground, or it's somewhere that's very hard to access if you're not specifically looking for it.
Right, but I think that's the whole point of the, when you buy that clue, I think the design was only the person who buys this clue is going to have a chance to find this idol.
Yeah, and I think maybe it's a testament to how well it was hidden that Malcolm wasn't able to find it.
Perhaps, I mean, a testament to Andrea, too, and her Mexican standoff skills. Yeah, I guess it's just more like, I like the idea that this is an open market for people. Everyone starts with the same, and you can snap, go all in, and lock yourself up an item, basically, and in Malcolm's case, almost lock himself up an idol. I like that people should be anticipating this and have to play around this, and it mixes the game up. Like, by design, it's going to the
often be the people who need it, that are getting these items that can help them back in the game. And I like that the other people have to know, like Cochran knew, I got to save some of this money potentially to keep these prizes out of other people's hands. I very much like that. Or what kind of role it should play in the game. All right. So let's just finishing up this auction here. Brenda, in one of the most epic metaphors for her entire Survivor career I've ever seen, after holding back and not being sure and going a little bit and halfway, finally, Eddie opens for $20. She just goes, covered item, $300. Fuck it. Let's go. I want something. And, of course, Brenda gets a pig's brain and actually tries it, but not so much the greatest delicacy, I think.
Yeah, but for some reason, when she said she didn't eat pork, my first thought was, she's Jewish. I was like, not sure why I like, made that connection.
I thought that might have been just like a bad joke. Like, oh, I forgot. Like, I would eat this, but I don't eat pork.
Maybe. Far be it for me to speculate about Asians' culinary habits.
Yeah, all right. And then I think the last item was everyone who had $20 left got to get a letter from their family, which was everyone but Don, Sherry, and Malcolm. And I thought Don was going to have an absolute meltdown here, but Don in one of her secret scenes, I want to talk about this. Don in one of her secret scenes basically said she didn't even want the letters because she felt so in control of her own self within the game. What did you think about this?
Hey, that strikes me. It's like the type of thing she would say, you know, in a pre-game interview, so I'm going to play the game with fewer emotions this time, I'm going to be more cutthroat, and then the moment the situation actually presents itself, she just falls apart again. But, maybe she was actually more composed this time.
It's not, like, Dawn is always just the type of person who's going to at least react to situations genuinely, but as far as actual action based on those reactions, what I've seen from her so far is Kreisenberg, this sobbing mom who actually, when push comes to shove, is making the tough calls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always wondered why they don't. I mean, I assume it's because they don't let them do that. But why other people don't just chip in 20 for other people buy their letters?
I no sharing of food or money, I guess.
But it's like it's not sharing. They are buying the letters for themselves, and they can just give it to them.
This is going to be a big shock. I like it that they didn't get their items. You spend your $500, you don't get your letter.
I guess that's what sharing is, right? Buying something and giving it to somebody else.
So, skipping ahead a little bit, Cochran's advantage, of course, ends up winning him the personal immunity necklace. And so, Cochran's got a bit of a challenge streak going on here, and he seems to be going to his head a little bit, maybe not. What are you thinking about this?
Yeah, I'm unsure how much of this new stick he seems to have, like seeing himself as a challenge beast, is really that sincere, or if it's just playing out for the cameras.
See, I mean, the facts are he's won half of the individual immunity challenges, and because he has weird eating habits and because he was smart to buy the clue, and I don't begrudge him any of that, I still am of the opinion that, like, this is too much for me. And it's hard to fault any of the individual circumstances, but it's pretty wild that Cochran's been winning all these challenges, and maybe he's just trying to set up good pre-merge meta for his third time playing, where, hey, I'm valuable in challenges, keep me around till the merge. But I think it's more coincidence than anything. But yeah, it seems like he seems to be pretty happy with himself, at least.
Yeah, and fair play to him. Like, you can't begrudge him being happy that the aspect of the Survivor that he thought he was worst at, he's now getting a chance to, if not like excel in objective terms, at least, you know, do well and win some of these things. I think the reason people are kind of turned off by it, though, is the fact that it's like Jeff Pro seems to be shoving the storyline down our throat. Like, Cochran is emerging as this new, like, Aussie Terry level challenge beast, whereas that's really not the case whatsoever.
Right, and I think, I don't think Cochran believes much of what he's saying about him actually being a challenge beast, but I do think there are definitely a lot of skeletons coming out of the closet, I guess, because I'm sure, you know, he took so much abuse basically because of his challenge performances when he was with Savai, that I do think this challenge streak has led to him now feeling like he wasn't as bad at challenges on Savai as he was, or he wasn't as costly as he once was. And I think perhaps unwarrantedly, but nonetheless, of course, this is a totally wild, anomalous challenge run. And I'm happy to see Cochran at least pulling some stuff off.
Right. And it might not have ended here, right? Because we're getting down to the end game now. There aren't that many people left. Let's say we're down to final six, final five, and Cochran, you know, gets a challenge that's well suited to him. He manages to win it. He could easily have won like three or four challenges by the end of the season, at which point that becomes an argument that he's able to make to a jury, which is not something I think he or anyone else would have been able to predict.
Oh, yeah, I certainly, if I'm sure when Yule was prepping him on what to do at Final Tribal Council, talking about all his challenge wins wasn't on the list.
But yeah, it's, I think he's going to get at least one more, though. I think we've seen too much of the Cochran is suddenly good at challenges for it to just be over after this. All right, so now a big point of interest is Malcolm has won his immunity idol clue. He's the only one who could conceivably find it. He goes and starts digging, has a little problem, in as much as that he can't find it, and Andrea and Cochran come up and see him actually digging for this, and Andrea decides to stick around and make sure that if he does in fact find this idol, she's going to be there and she's going to know whether or not he's got it. Now, my question is, Andrea shows up and he just stops digging. And from what we understand, he didn't spend too much time digging beyond that. Why the hell not, Dom? What does he care if Stealtharos knows?
See, this is one of the most frustrating thing about the reaction by the fanbase to episodes. And I mean, we're going to do this too, just this rampant speculation about things we're not qualified to judge because we weren't there. But like, when people just say, "Oh, why didn't Malcolm keep looking for the idol?" Like, Malcolm would have thought of that. He's not stupid. He's not just going to suddenly stop looking because somebody's there. Like, if he did stop looking, there would be a reason for it. He's not just going to get overconfident or whatever. Like, the account as he gave it, and I see no reason to doubt him really, is that by the time this has happened, he already looked everywhere that the idol could conceivably be, given what was on the note, and he knew that he pretty much wasn't going to find it. So when Andrew turns up, like, how's he supposed to respond to that? Does he just keep digging? Well, it's already proven fruitless so far, so there's no point continuing to do it. The best thing he can do at that stage is to pretend that he has it, and the only way he can do that is to not look anymore.
See, and this is exactly what listening to his exit interview and everything, this was, I believe, his exact plan. There's a secret scene of him actually this week dropping his old idol wrapping paper, trying to make it look like, very obviously, that he found a new idol. Hoping Andrea and Brenda would happen upon it.
And Brenda sees through it, just saying.
Well, job well done there, Brenda. I don't think Malcolm's that sloppy to leave if he did, in fact, find it. The thing for me is, like, you have to weight the efficiency if he did go and continue looking and that's all he did and found the idol and could use it and could potentially do something with it versus how likely this bluff is to work. And given that Brenda instantly saw through it, I think this bluff is going to work about 0% of the time, especially when they have the votes to split it no matter what.
Yeah, but I mean, what else is he going to do? Like, because I have to imagine if he thought there was a realistic chance of finding it, he would continue to look for it. But like, maybe because the clue he was given at the auction was very specific, right? It was saying you have to look in this certain place. Maybe he misread it and went to the wrong place, and then like obviously there he just couldn't find it no matter what. Or
I hadn't even considered that he was looking at, because the clue I upon rewatching this episode was very specific about there's a tree growing and vines, and 6 inches below the vines underground there's this idol, and we can see him like there's only so much around those vines. I have to imagine he was just in the wrong place. I know he was by the well and everything, but I think that's actually probably like the only realistic explanation is he did not remember the clue correctly.
Yeah, like given that it's, 6 inches underground or whatever, if you dig in a certain place and it's not there, it's not like you can just like uproot the earth that's right next to you. You have to dig another hole and keep looking for it.
Right.
So it's not like it's hidden just beneath the surface or something.
I still feel like at the end, running this bluff, unless it's 10 minutes before tribal council, I don't even know about it. I just feel like this bluff is never going to work, and I don't care if Stealtharos knows that I have it, so every waking minute that I don't have it, I'm going to be out there.
Yeah, for some reason, I just found that that one criticism, why didn't Malcolm keep looking for the idol, that one was just particularly annoying for me.
Okay. I mean, because the theory is that he misremembered or what? Because I feel like that's a pretty big leak. And I'm sure there's a reasonable explanation and everything, but I'm not leaving that well.
Yeah, I guess it's just the undertone of, oh, Malcolm is so stupid. Didn't you realize you're getting voted out and he's an idol? No, of course he knew that, but like, it's...
Okay.
I just don't... Like, the presumption when people say that is that, you know, they saw something that Malcolm didn't, or how can Malcolm be so stupid as to not realize this basic concept? And... Well, that's just not the case. He did realize it. He still couldn't find it. Okay, sometimes that happens.
Right, yeah, okay. That's definitely fair. And I suppose Malcolm, among people who play Survivor, has at least earned the benefit of the doubt when it comes to finding hidden immunity idols.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm saying is, let's say Andrew never turns up there. How likely do you think it is that Malcolm finds it? I mean, given the fact that by that point he still hadn't found it, probably not very high.
I guess for me it's, he's 100% fucked without it. If he stops looking, he can't get it, so why stop looking?
Yeah, I just think people make far too much of this.
Okay. Yeah, that's and we perhaps made far too much of it ourselves.
I say that after we spent like an hour discussing one specific topic from like 2 weeks ago. So,
well, in our defense, that is, by my opinion, like the most interesting position in the history of Survivor, with so many variables and so many just like permutations, basically.
I think you're displaying your usual penchant for hyperbole, but I agree with the sentiment.
Okay. I mean, yeah, okay, you're right, Dom. Now I can't stop thinking of more interesting travel count. Okay, whatever. So, not to undersell what after 25 episodes was a very solid run on Survivor, but once Malcolm doesn't have that idol, he's gonna go home there every time, assuming the favorites are playing well, which they did. And so Malcolm's gone, he gets voted out. I had roughly the same reaction as that little girl crying on YouTube. Dom, what'd you think about this? And more importantly, I think, what are you thinking about Malcolm now as his legacy pertains to Survivor? I think he's gonna be one of the more interesting ones.
Yeah, I'm not a rabid Malcolm fantard or anything, but I really appreciate what he brought to the show. He's someone who he has all the standard qualities you want in a Survivor player. Like he's charismatic, he's good looking, he's smart, he gives good confessionals, yeah, he's good in challenges. He always gives his all to everything, and he's not the kind of person who you can ever accuse of playing passively. Right, he's always going to be always going to be in there mixing it up. And when it's correct for him to lay back, he's going to do so in a way that's entertaining. But he's not the kind of person whose entertainment value is tied to like any one characteristic, and so when that's not on display, he just falls into the background.
Yeah, Malcolm is going to be tough for me to think about historically, because his skill, I think just his innate skill set is pretty ridiculous, just even in historical context, just his natural ability with people and his mind, his enthusiasm for the game and everything that's just kind of a part of his personality is going to have a ton of good things going for him when it comes to playing Survivor. And the thing I probably appreciate the most is that you're right. He's not playing passively. He is there for first place and first place only. And I love that. But the problem is, it's not worked out. So what do we make of this?
Well, I think the best comparison I've heard is to like JT, and specifically JT in Heroes vs. Villains, where someone who I think clearly, despite the same skill set that he showed in Talking Teams, one which carried him to maybe more effortless of victory than almost anybody else.
Actually, I hadn't considered that, but I think that is a really strong comparison, where both are active, like clearly not going to take a back seat, going for only first place, which again, I my favorite thing to see in a player. Charming as hell, crazy innate social skills and enthusiasm for the game and everything. I'm very much on board with that, like making aggro moves every time, even though, not every time, but when necessary, and being able to hang back when necessary and never getting on people's bad sides at all.
Yeah, and I think another similarity between them is that both of them, maybe this is just my interpretation, but they both seem to rely quite heavily on having like a good psychic, a good sounding board that could like keep them in check and rein them in, maybe when their impulses were too aggressive or whatever. Like, I think we saw that with Denise in Philippines, with Steven in Talking Teams, and I think in both of their second seasons, they didn't really have anyone to step in and fill that role. Like, JT didn't really have anybody, and Malcolm, I guess I had Corinne, but Corinne enabled the worst aspects of Malcolm's game rather than the best.
I think that's a very fair point, actually. Yeah, Corinne is not the soundboard you necessarily want, I don't think. But yeah, you're right. And maybe, do you feel like that was an issue here? Did Malcolm get out of control here? Not out of control, but did he get overly aggressive?
Well, it's hard to say, right? Because you can say that the ideas he displayed at each... Okay, you say that the ideas he was going for at each point were pretty sound, but just the execution was maybe not up to scratch. But I guess the other argument would be, though, that, like, just, for instance, siding with the wrong group of favorites at the first place was just a fundamental mistake, and that maybe with somebody else in space Corinne, he doesn't make that decision.
Right. I think, going a little bit back to Malcolm and JT, like, JT specifically in Heroes vs. Villains again, where they're taking shots to win this, basically. And I think Malcolm, if we can nitpick the idol thing for an hour, which we just did, or the double idol thing for an hour, which we just did, at the end of the day, he's not a perfect player, but his just natural abilities with people and intelligence and everything like that is going to more than make up for. And I'll take someone who's not as good at Malcolm at the things he's not trying to be good at, but is very good at the game. I'll take Malcolm over that, given that he's an imperfect player still.
I'm having trouble passing that at 5 in the morning, but yeah, I agree.
Basically, I think Steven's a better tactician than JT, but I'll take JT in a random season to win more than Steven.
I can see that. Although, I'd have to say, in Malcolm's case, I think I take Denise over Malcolm.
So would I.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, let's talk briefly about that then. How does Malcolm stack up for you, like, historically? Is it too soon or roughly? Do you have a range?
I don't think it's too soon. Like, it's not. There's nothing time-sensitive about his legacy, I don't think. All I'd say is that, he's the kind of guy who's tough to rank because he clearly is very good at the things you need to be good at in order to do well at Survivor. But at the same time, just, like, he's making what seems to be these big errors over and over again, just, like, dropping the ball unnecessarily. And maybe the conclusion we should draw from that is that he doesn't have, like, the complete skill set you need to just to really do well in the game. Like, okay, you can say he was one challenge away from winning in Philippines, but you can also say he was one conversation with Denise, which he could easily have had away from winning Philippines.
Exactly, exactly. Right, and it's like, okay, well, this is Malcolm's biggest flaw. Malcolm is not a closer, despite always playing for first. he's a choke artist, basically, and it's something I'm quite familiar with, and that sucks. But that's, I think, the biggest hindrance for him, and also the notion that he's just so well-liked that it's hard for him to get people to take him to the end ever, I think really knocks off his general equity.
Yeah, Malcolm's the kind of guy who is never going to be able to disappear into the background, as much as he might like to try. Like, he's always going to be seen as, like, this young, studly Adonis who everyone's fallen in love with, and so, like, it's weird because everyone likes him, but not to the extent that people like, for instance, Kim, where it's just so overwhelming that they're just blindly willing to do whatever they say.
Right, they don't set the game aside so they can please Kim in all aspects of life, basically.
Yeah, you could say maybe Malcolm did this for, like, Pete, for instance, or Carla, like, with certain groups of people, Malcolm might have that kind of effect, but in general, I don't think it's there.
Yeah, certainly not to the same degree. And I think JT is, if not, I think Kim probably at this point is number one on that in that regard. But I think JT's high on that list, and I think Malcolm is.
Yeah, to play devil's advocate though, like, you can say that in the Philippines, he was there with a predominantly older crowd, people that would be more likely to be immune to his charms. Just seeing the way that people get on with him this season, like, for instance, if you put him together with Andrea on a non-All-Star season where metagame situations aren't in play, I can easily see her just being completely taken in by him.
That doesn't sound like the Andrea Belkey I know, Dom. She doesn't get romantically entangled and distracted from the game.
Right, yeah. And maybe she isn't, like, a representative example, but, like, I feel like if you put Malcolm on a predominantly young tribe, he's going to do incredibly well. If you put him on an older tribe, they're going to see him for the thread he is, and he's going to be cut loose when they no longer need him.
Well, I think if you're putting him on an older tribe, they're presumably he's not going to be the only young person. I think he's got a lot of staying power as long as there are some other young people around. Like, I think he's good at connecting with older people, but not to the point that they're not like JT connecting with Coach and Debbie and whatever, to the point that they're willing to change their game to let him get to the end and then vote for him gladly after he's voted them out.
Right, but JT, that, like, his game in Brazil was a very, like, it was that kind of demographic effect in action, right? You put JT with a bunch of, you know, older people, a bunch of Southern people, a bunch of devout Christians, and yeah, they're going to fall head over heels in love with him. If you put, you know, JT on, like, on a different season, maybe he doesn't have that same kind of impact.
Right.
And similarly, if you set up a season for Malcolm and he's with a younger cast, people who he's disposed to get on well with, then maybe you see the same kind of utter dominance.
I think Malcolm could quite easily find himself in a lot of starting positions where he could absolutely just crush and assuming not like entering the merge down numbers or whatever. And even still, you know, Mattson goes in with 2 out of 11 or whatever. I think that a lot of things are often going to go really well for Malcolm. I think there's some fundamentals that are slightly lacking that really, I don't have him as like an elite player. I don't think he's a top 10 player. I don't think he's a top 20 player at this point because this is not Big Brother. This is Survivor. There have been some very good players. Don't forget it. So I think he's somewhere, he's an extremely talented player, but he's not on near the top of my list at this point.
Yeah. For some reason, I have difficulty placing him in like some kind of top X category or whatever. I'm not sure that's a question it makes sense to ask yet at this point. But yeah, he's clearly someone who is very, very good, a few standard deviations above average.
Yeah, and he's a hell of a likable guy, and he's going to be the next host of Survivor.
Maybe.
Book it. All right.
Okay.
So, let's see. We got a double boot episode coming up next week. I'm assuming we're going to lose one bro in Brenda. Do you disagree?
I feel like what we saw in the preview is the episode. It's the episode in a microcosm. So is Reynolds going to win immunity? No. Well, yeah. Thanks for playing, Reynolds. Good game. And then I'd imagine Eddie. Like, it could be Brenda, but I think the default there has to be Eddie. We haven't seen. Well, I mean, we haven't seen anything from Brenda, but we haven't seen any reason why she would be specifically the next to go here. You know, maybe she's higher up in the like in the pecking order there than we expect. We don't know.
Well, the only reason I'm saying that, not because of game logic at all, is because we just started seeing her last week, and that seems to be their new favorite trick.
Right, but it's also possible that we're just not going to see her again until she pops up in the finale, gets booted, and nobody cares other than me.
Well, we can only hope.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what else we even want to be so much looking ahead at this point, because I think we're both just surely confident that this is John Cochran's the winner of this season, and it's just a matter of how. What do you think about that? All but reality that Cochran's going to be a Survivor winner.
It's still kind of surreal. I expect to be less happy about it than I thought I ever would be. Like if you told me that Cochran's going to win Survivor, and I'm not sure whether that's a reaction against like him winning Survivor or if it's just my displeasure with the season as a whole.
Okay, I could definitely see. In assuming Cochran wins, I can see why Jeff Probst is giving it so much hype, because I'm sure he's like, oh, this is such a giant character and so many crazy tribal councils and everything. But yeah, I don't feel like whatever happens, however this plays out, I don't think it's going to be a particularly impressive win. It's going to be exactly what we said preseason, which is he was gifted an amazing starting position and didn't mess it up. Not only did he not mess it up, he's been really, really impressive to me as far as his gameplay and interactions go. Maybe no for you.
Well, it's just I'm willing to believe that. I would like to believe that, but there's just not been any evidence. Like it seems to consist mainly of when someone comes up to him, like, and they're scared and they're telling him information, and he doesn't alienate them, and that's supposed to be like a step up from previously, which is why it's a great achievement. I don't know. Like the thing to me is that so far we haven't seen him have to face any obstacles. Like if we think. As we said, he was on this perfect starting try for him. Couldn't have drawn it up any better if he tried. Then after a swap, he's with all of his old allies. He still has a majority. Then after the merge, sure, there's a lot of craziness happening, but nothing that actually threatens his hold on the game at all. And he's still in the majority all the way through. I think the big decision point for him is going to be if and when he turns on Andrea, because for some reason, Andrea seems to be like, identified by everyone else as the ringleader of that group. And so I can see her making a pretty good case for herself if she does make it to the end. And I think that dynamic of if and when they're going to turn on her is going to be like the big thing that's supposed to hold our attention in the coming episodes.
Yeah, and this is honestly kind of why I've very much enjoyed these last few episodes, but a bit dissatisfied with the season, because it just seems so clear already when Andrea could be making a compelling case, Dawn could be making a compelling case if she's there, and we're just not having any reason to believe that there's going to be suspense as far as, you know, at least like experienced Survivor viewers, which at this point is like 90% of the Survivor audience.
Well, also, the other thing this season has been so thoroughly strange that, you know, Cochran's edit, which I think in most other seasons would stand out as, if not impressive, but at least like remarkable in some way. It's that just stands far above everything else, and no one else has really had any kind of consistent edit at all. You know, Dawn has transformed into Lisa. Sherry is either invisible or this dominatrix. Andrea's had like content in every episode, but the trouble with her edit is that there's no kind of consistent storyline running through it there. Like, we don't know who she wants to go to the end with. We don't know about her relationship with any of the jurors. It's just been something happens, Andrea reacts to it at the end, and then that just gets repeated over and over again. Going up to this episode, Malcolm looked like he was the only serious challenger for that title, and now he's been dethroned as well. So, yeah, it's just not competitive at this point.
Yeah, and that's disappointing. Although I will say, and again, we're taking a lot of things for granted here, but I think that's a safe bet. And perhaps we're wrong, and this is going to be 10 times worse than South Pacific when we were giving Coach 80% win equity at the merge and every subsequent episode. But at the same time, like, I'm going to be happy for him. I'm going to be impressed with the way he played. I have a couple concerns from some of the stuff I've been seeing about him along this kind of journey, where I feel like he's felt good along the way, like specifically that reward where they went rappelling and he gave that confessional about, I'm not going to engage in this masculine tomfoolery with these knuckleheads. And I am hoping to see out of Cochran upon victory that he kind of act like he's been there before. And I know that's tough considering he's loved this game for so long. I just have concerns that he may get, and not for any substantial amount of time, but a little bit too big for his britches.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's possible that he kind of, like, swings to the other end of the pendulum, if you like, upon winning. I don't want to speculate about that. Yeah. I mean, hopefully we get the chance to talk to him again in person, and we can go through the events of the season in detail with him. But until then, we just have to wait.
Yeah, and let this be a lesson to former Survivor players. Come on the Dom and Colin podcast, win your next season of Survivor.
We managed to go through, 3 hours without any whoring, so I should throw it in at the end there.
All right, anything else that we want to be getting to today, Dom? I know we've hit on a lot.
I want to get to bed, if that's possible.
All right, well, that sounds good. Guys, thank you very much for listening. And I think that's going to do it. So subscribe on iTunes if you haven't already. We're going to be back next week, and we will talk to you then, guys. Take care.